This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Van O'Dell. Today is September 9, 2008. I am in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. O'Dell is joining me in Katy, Texas. Is that correct, sir?
Yes.
Okay. All right, why don't we begin, if you don't mind, telling me a little bit of biographical information. When and where you were born, what your parents' names were, what their occupations were, that type of thing.
Okay. I was born in June 10th, 1949, in Stillwater, Oklahoma.
Okay.
My parents were George Van O'Dell, Jr., mm-hmm. and Betty Jean Fugit O'Dell. My father was born in Earlsboro, Oklahoma. My mother was born in Maud, Oklahoma. My father is a professor, was a professor at Oklahoma State University.
Okay.
And my mother was a office manager at Oklahoma State University.
All right. Could you tell me a little bit about your childhood, about growing up in Stillwater?
Sure. It was a small university town. I grew up there and also in College Station, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them small university towns. had a real great childhood, lots of Boy Scouting, spent a lot of time camping,
mm-hmm.
fishing, spent a tremendous amount of time in the woods in around Stillwater, went to public schools,
okay.
and went all the way through high school there and graduated from Stillwater High School,
okay.
Became an Eagle Scout. Worked from the time I was 11 years old on.
Mm-hmm.
Always had a part-time job from the time I was 11. I took two paper routes.
Okay.
Kept those all the way through several other various jobs while I was there. And I don't know what else to say about it. It was a rather Ozzie and Harriet type family.
Yes, sir.
Had a brother and a sister.
Okay.
And like I said, my father's a professor, and we just lived in and around the university. I spent lots of time up in the museums and up in the university labs
mm-hmm.
all the time I was growing up.
Right. What did your father teach?
He was actually a researcher in biochemistry.
Okay.
He did teach organic chemistry and biochemistry, and he used to teach the washout course for vet med students.
Okay.
Called Biochemistry 4113.
All right. Okay. Could you tell me a little bit about high school for you? Did you enjoy high school, and what were your favorite subjects?
Oh, no, I absolutely hated high school. It was a miserable experience. As a matter of fact, I look back on my life, Vietnam was a lot more fun than high school. It was a pretty horrible place to be. It was a real cliquish group.
Mm-hmm.
There were very few people on the in crowd, and they pretty much controlled the school. It was like most of those tribal experiences.
Sure.
And it was, I did not enjoy high school at all. As a matter of fact, I only took, I was preparing myself for university, which I really didn't want to do at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I took one shop course in welding, and it was the only course I enjoyed the whole time I was in high school.
Okay.
I was ready to be out of school and wanted to be on my own just as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And when did you graduate from high school?
1967.
1967. Okay. As you were going through high school and you graduated in 67, were you paying attention at all to, or did you know anything about what was going on in Vietnam?
Oh, yeah. I was news junkie all my life. I had watched it on the news,
mm-hmm.
and I wanted to go over and be in it.
Okay. All right. So did you join the Navy right out of high school then?
No, I actually joined before I was out of high school.
Oh, okay.
Way back in 1966 on the reserve program.
Okay.
So I drilled for almost a year before I graduated.
Mm-hmm.
My senior year I was in the Naval Reserve,
mm-hmm.
and I graduated in 67, and I was already an E3 petty officer, and from there I went to boot camp and then on to A school and became an E4 or a third class gunner's mate.
Okay. All right. What made you choose the Navy?
Oh, my father had been in the Navy.
Okay.
And several other military members have been in the Navy in our family all the way back to the Civil War. So I had he had been in World War II as a fire control technician in the Pacific Fleet and also in the Atlantic.
Okay.
And I just wanted to be in the Navy. I think that most people, if you'll look at most of the major admirals in the Navy, they came from Kansas and Oklahoma and Central Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Very few of them are seafaring type people, but I think the being landlocked, you just kind of want to go on the ocean.
Right. Yes, sir. Well, did your father tell you anything about his experiences when you were growing up?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we talked about his experiences in World War II, and he told us about what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And we discussed, also, my grandfather was a historian and in his own right. And we talked about American history and world history. But, yes, he did. He talked to me about his experiences in the Navy.
Okay.
Quite extensively.
All right. So then that had a great effect on you then, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that certainly did.
Okay. Let's see. So you went through the reserves. You began in the reserves. Could you tell me a little bit about how that worked?
Sure. Okay. At that time, you could join the Navy in a couple of different ways. One
mm-hmm.
was regular Navy, which was 4 years active and 2 years reserve, or like I did it, which was 2 years active duty and 4 years reserves, total of 6 years for both. Being from Stillwater, Oklahoma, I knew not any other way to do it, because there just was this Naval Reserve Station, and a bunch of us, actually there were six of us, who still get together every once in a while, who just didn't have anything to do one Saturday night, and we decided we'd go join the Navy. And so we went down and got our papers, and I wasn't old enough, so I had to go get my parents to sign for me.
Mm-hmm.
But it just basically was a product of... I was ready to get out of Stillwater, Oklahoma, and I didn't know how, and this mm-hmm. looked like a way to do it.
Right. And what did your father think whenever you told him about joining the Navy?
He thought it was a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
He had done the same thing. He had joined when he was 17 also.
Okay. All right. Once you graduated from high school, was it then straight to basic?
I left 2 days after I graduated from high school and went to basic training in San Diego.
Okay.
It was on the... They were running people through very quickly, so we went through an accelerated boot camp, which was only a couple of weeks long because we had been training for almost a year at the reserve unit, learning basic military, how to salute, how to wear your uniform, all the really extremely basic stuff there in Stillwater.
Mm-hmm.
So we went to a couple of weeks in San Diego to boot camp, and then we got on an airplane and they flew us to Seattle, Washington, and we spent 2 weeks on a destroyer escort, the USS Whitehurst, DE-634.
Okay.
And for another couple of weeks of training, and then I returned back to the Reserve Center from there.
Okay. Can you tell me about the accelerated boot camp in San Diego, and just a typical day? How would it be different than your regular basic training as far as a typical day? Or could?
Well, they were exactly the same as a typical day, but we were brought in and just put in with everybody else. We just didn't stay as long.
Mm-hmm.
But we would get up in the morning about 5 o'clock.
Okay.
And they'd come yelling and screaming and knocking the beds over, getting us out of bed. And then they'd you'd have to very quickly dress, get your rack made up, get outside on the parade ground for a few minutes of calisthenics, where they would come around and scream at you and beat on you a little bit. Then we would march off to breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
And then after a while, after a very quick breakfast, you would march to classes all day, and the classes would entail anything from knot tying to rope splicing. We went out and spent 2 days on fire control, where things would be set on fire and we'd have to put the fire out.
Mm-hmm.
They had a mock ship out in the middle of the desert that different rooms would catch on fire and you'd have to put the fires out.
Mm-hmm.
We went through a gas mask thing where we put on a gas mask and you went into a room and they shot tear gas all over you. And then the last second you ripped off your mask and took a deep breath and then ran out so you get a taste of it.
Mm-hmm.
The problem was that they got to the last 10 guys in our company, and I was one of them, they didn't have any more gas masks. So we had to go in there and spend the full 10 minutes without a gas mask on in the tear gas room.
Goodness.
And then run out. And then we would usually have lunch sometime during that time. They'd march you to lunch. You'd have a very quick lunch. You'd get out. You'd go to more classrooms. They could be anything from television classrooms to actually hands-on type things, discussing how a ship works, the inner workings of how you act on a ship, and what your job is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Whether at that point we were all brand new, so you're either going to be on the deck gang or be in engineering as a snipe, which would be work down in the engine rooms. Then at the end of the day, after dinner, there'd be another class or two or another type of work session. We'd do some type of, then you'd strip off your clothes and you'd wash them in these big concrete tubs.
Mm-hmm.
And hang them up. The Navy had these things called clothes ties, which are just a series of great big strings, and you would tie your, and supposedly you use these on board ship, but you never did after boot camp. But you would tie your clothes out, so everything that you wore that day would be washed and hung out on the lines to dry to be picked up before 5 o'clock the next morning, folded and put back in your locker.
Okay.
You were given the same size lockers you got on board ship, which is about 18 inches by 18 inches by 24 inches deep.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that you own goes in that locker.
Okay.
And the one thing about it, of course, this naval base is no longer in operation, but there was this huge fence that ran right down between two buildings. These buildings were old Spanish-style two-story barracks, San Diego-style. And on the other side was the Marine Corps. And they were running their Marines through, getting them to Vietnam as quickly as they could.
Right.
And we'd get out at 5 o'clock in the morning. We'd look across the fence, and there'd be these Marines in the sweatshirts and green pants carrying telephone poles. And then when we came in at night, they'd be carrying telephone poles.
Mm-hmm.
We got up the next morning, they'd be out carrying telephone poles. And I was sure glad I wasn't in the Marine Corps.
Right.
And that's about all they ever did.
So
that was a typical day that we would have. But we went through all sorts of shipboard, you know, customs, how you acted, what you did on board ship, how to operate on board ship, and that type of thing. And that's what is basically the basic training to be a sailor on a ship.
Okay. All right. Did you have any weapons training in basic?
No.
Okay.
Not at all. We were not even allowed to carry guns. The most of the companies had rifles,
mm-hmm.
1903 Springfields,
right.
From World War One and up to World War Two, and we used those to march the first day. And about the second day, one of the guys doing about face, rifle barrel hit the guy behind him and gashed his face wide open, so they just took all the guns away from us, and we didn't have any guns the rest of the time we were there, which was great because he didn't have to carry the damn thing.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. What was your thoughts on the training? Did you think it was fairly adequate or not?
Well, to be perfectly honest, I didn't have any thoughts at the time. It,
right.
It was quite adequate for what we were doing. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, it was all accelerated. I did that. I also went to accelerated A school for gunnery.
Right.
Later on. But, at that time, they were running us through as quickly as they possibly could.
Mm-hmm.
So it was adequate enough to get somebody to where they didn't kill themselves on the first day on the job.
Right. Okay.
But it was not the in-depth, detailed stuff that they do nowadays.
Right. Okay.
And I'm still involved with the Navy quite a bit, so
okay.
I know what they're doing.
Right. What about the instructors? What was your thoughts on them?
Well, they were. It was a chief. We had one. He was a chief engineman,
mm-hmm.
And he came in about 5 o'clock in the morning and left about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And he was there just kind of doing his job. He was marking time, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Was there any mention of Vietnam at all during basic?
Well, the one thing this happened is that we were brought in to a room, and this was during the 7-day Israeli war with all of the Arab countries.
Mm-hmm.
When they were attacked, and we were told that we might be pulled out, and there were two things that happened at this time. That we were told that we might be pulled out and put on ships and taken over to the Mediterranean
mm-hmm.
to support Israel at the time. But by the time all that blew over, Israel had already defeated the Egyptians and Jordanians and Iraqis and everybody else,
right.
The Syrians. But, and I got to visit the Egyptian Museum of that war just a couple of years ago, and didn't realize it, but Egypt says they won the war according to the museum.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Thank you for their victory during that Saturday war. But
Vietnam
was discussed, but the main reason thing that Vietnam was discussed at that time is that they were training gunner's mates to go on the battleships they were bringing out. They were bringing out the New Jersey, and possibly they were thinking about bringing out the Missouri also at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And they needed hundreds and hundreds of gunner's mates to go man these big guns. And at that time, the Navy's full and absolute mission in Vietnam, besides fighter planes over North Vietnam, was coastal patrol
mm-hmm.
and offshore naval gun bombardment. And so that's where the Navy was focused at that time.
Okay. And so that's where you thought you would probably end up then, huh?
Well, I was too stupid at the time when I joined up to not realize that the Navy didn't go on land, which was completely different than what happened later on. But no, I thought that or some destroyer escort or something. I just wanted to be out in the fleet someplace,
right?
On some type of patrol. But yes, I was too young at the time to even realize what was going on, actually in country.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, before we move on to A school and to gunner's mate school, could you tell me, were there any other particularly memorable moments from basic that stick out in your mind?
Oh, it was just I just was smart enough, having gone through a lot of stuff in Boy Scouts and having been on my own, you know, camping and doing things like that, to be able to handle myself and be quiet in group situations. We had several guys that didn't quite understand that they needed to keep their mouth shut and run below the radar, and they were hit and abused by the drill instructors quite often.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to avoid all that just by flying under the radar.
Right.
It was, as far as that, on board ship in when we went to the second part of the training, which was up in Seattle, Washington, it was just really something to. They gave us one afternoon off, one Sunday afternoon off. We got to put on our dress whites and go out into the town itself as sailors, which was rather an interesting deal at the time, because coming from a small town in Oklahoma, this is my first foray into the other parts of the United States at that time. So it was just really an eye-opening experience. So to see, and I went down, and I'll relay a story about Jackson and Pike Street later on when we talk about Vietnam.
Okay.
We went down to Jackson and Pike Street, where all the bars and all the wild nights went on.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, we couldn't do anything because we were only 18 years old at the time. So we pretty much just looked in the windows and then went back to the ship.
Right. Okay. Was there any negative reaction to you guys at this time?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, we were quite welcomed in the city at this time. This was 1967. That
mm-hmm.
hadn't really started.
Right.
But there was no negative reaction at all. We were just, or no positive reaction either way.
Right.
We were just, they had quite a few sailors in Seattle and Bremerton at that time, so it wasn't anything big with them either way.
Okay. All right. And this was when you were in gunner's mate school?
No. This was when I was just finishing up the second part of the boot camp.
Oh, okay.
The week cruise up in Seattle, Washington.
Okay. I got you. Okay. So once you finished up basic, did you go straight to gunner's mate school? Was there any time in between?
I went back to the reserve unit for about, about 4 or 5 months.
Mm-hmm.
And completed the rest of the training.
Okay.
And became an E3 at that time. And I went to Gunner's Mate A School September of... Yeah, the last of September of 67, I went to North Chicago Naval Base and flew up there and started 16 weeks of Gunner's Mate A School.
Okay.
That was a chosen rate. That was the, I put in the two or three rates I wanted to be, and that was the one that came back. They kind of have this dream sheet where you ask for what you want, and sometimes you get it, sometimes you don't. But that was one of them. And at that time, it was gunnery, which is the large guns, the 5-inch 38s and the 3-inch 71s, and then the also the 16-inch that were on the New Jersey at the time. And we were training to be gunner's mates up there. And it was pretty much all classroom work, but they had a huge area that had all of the guns that could be moved. But there's two rates there that go to school. One is gunner's mate guns.
Mm-hmm.
Which is all guns, and the other side is gunner's mate missiles, which is all the three. At that time, the Navy had three different missiles that they fired off ships.
Okay. And which were you trained to?
I was trained as gunner's mate guns.
Guns,
so,
okay.
I was trained on all the big weapons.
Okay. All right. And could you take me through a typical day of this training?
Sure. It was the gunnery school was a huge, giant, all glass building with green glass, and they it was our barracks was right across the street from it. It was like I said, in North Chicago. Abbott Labs, the pharmacies, had one of their production facilities up there, and they used to spew out some of the nastiest chemicals, and it stunk all the time. You shared a room with four other people. You had two desks, so two of you shared a desk, four beds, two bunk beds, and a small locker.
Okay.
You were not allowed to wear jeans at any time. You could only wear your naval uniform any time on and off the base. You could never wear civilian clothes at any time. You would get up and go eat breakfast about 7 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Classes started at 0800. And they were usually all lecture classes, and they would lecture from 0800 till somewhere around noon. There would be a short break for lunch.
Mm-hmm.
You'd come back, and there would be lectures all afternoon long till about 5 o'clock. On Fridays, you would take a test, and if you passed the test, you got the weekend off. If you flunked the test, you went to dumbfuck, which you went back up there, and you studied all weekend long. And every night the next week for 3 hours.
Okay.
And then after, then if you passed the next test, then you got off a dumb fuck, basically is what it was called.
Mm-hmm.
And you were able to do that. But you could very easily be spending 15 hours a day in a classroom if you weren't doing your work. If you flunked three times, you were flunked out of school and you went directly to the fleet and you didn't get your training. We usually got most weekends off.
Okay.
And there were you could go up to Kenosha or someplace in Wisconsin. You go down to Chicago and walk around. Trouble was, by that time it was getting cold.
Mm-hmm.
The Navy pea coat isn't the best thing in the world to keep the cold off of. But there and then there was a little military town across the way where the people just tried to get all the money they could out of you every time you walked over there. They had a lot of shysters over there and people who would take advantage of you.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to watch that. But we went, we had, let's see. Yeah, that's pretty much what a day would be like.
Okay. All right. So there was no hands-on training then?
Not really. We had, I take that back. There was some hands-on training. We had, 5-inch 38s and 3-inch 54s down below, which you could rope, which were all in working order. There was no ammunition, of course, because they were inside of a building.
Right.
But we went over all the hydraulic systems. You were taught the different hydraulic systems, how they worked, servo units, how they worked, how to clean and operate, how to keep the things clean and lubricated, safety precautions and that type of thing. But in the most part, no, there was not any hands-on. But we went through all the weapons that the Navy used on ships. And basically, these weapons at this time were still things that came out of World War II. There hadn't been much upgrading except for the missiles on the other side of the building,
right,
which the missilemen were working on.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as what I was doing, it was still World War II type weapons.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what were your thoughts on this training? Pretty good, or?
It was very good training. It was long and very detailed. And after having gotten out of high school, I really didn't want to go back to school, but it was an opportunity that I took advantage of, and it got me rated to third-class gunner's mate. Now, one of the good things about this was that I talked about my Boy Scout training earlier, mm-hmm. the fact that I was an Eagle Scout. I could tie all the knots. I could do all the deck stuff, so I never had to do any mess cooking. When everybody else was down on the mess decks cleaning dishes, I never had to do that.
Right.
And then because I went to Gunner's Mate A School and became third class before I even went on active duty, I got out of all sorts of nasty type duties and was able to just go do technical type stuff, which
mm-hmm.
was a big benefit.
Okay. All right. Could you tell me a little about your instructors here at the Gunner's Mate School?
They were, for the most part, they were chief gunner's mates, a couple of first class gunner's mates. They had done well in the fleet and were top-type sailors, but they were not instructors. They, having taught quite a bit lately in my life, I recognize a good instructor and a poor instructor. And they were basically just up there to throw out some information however they could and just yell at you. This was back, the Navy's changed quite a bit. The Navy used to be extremely lily-white, just absolutely no people of color whatsoever, a rarity, and they were also extremely stratified. There's almost a royal hierarchy in the officers' ranks coming on down and then in the upper enlisted ranks. The Army, having the same type of rank system, was a little bit more, wasn't quite have those lines drawn. But these guys were kind of king of the roost, and if they wanted to abuse you in any way, they could, you know, scream and yell and make you do all sorts of stuff. But it was a good school. The commanding officer of the school was a limited duty officer, which meant he rose through the enlisted ranks and was lieutenant commander at this time. And he was real good. He was really wanting to put on a good school and he was interested in teaching. He was interested in seeing that things went on well, but it varied from good instructors to poor instructors.
Okay.
That we had.
All right. And were there any particularly memorable moments about this training that stick out in your mind?
Yeah, there's a couple of them. I'll tell you that went off the thing. There was one of them was the first time it snowed real hard and heavy.
Mm-hmm.
They called from the barracks. They said, everybody that lives in the south, report to the duty station. So we all went out there and reported to the duty station, and they gave us shovels, and we had to shovel all the sidewalks by hand. A couple of days later, we got another huge snowfall, and they called out all the boys from the north,
mm-hmm.
and they gave them snow plows
to
plow the snow. So that's one of the things. They pull crap like that on.
Right.
Another memorable one that I thought, of course, being a young kid from Stillwater, this guy was there. He'd been in the Navy for a while, and he said, hey, let's go to Kenosha. There's a real neat nightclub up there. They'll let you in even though you're underage, and we'll go up there and have some beers and have a good time. They've got lots of girls. So we hopped on the train, went to Kenosha. Of course, it's freezing weather. There's snow all over the ground. It was freezing to death, and we walk into this nightclub, and they have a place to hang your jackets, and we hang our coats up, and we go and sit down and have a couple of beers, and the club's wild, and there's dance band going on, and there's girls, and then the club shuts down, and we had to go get a hotel room.
Mm-hmm.
And the two of us got a small hotel room, had one bed we were going to share because we pulled our money together, go up there for this one big night. And we go out, and someone had stole our coats.
Uh-oh.
So here we are with no coats. It's snowing like crazy. It's just cold. The wind's blowing. And we go back down to the hotel room, and they had rented out our room. We didn't have a room.
Goodness.
So we had to hitchhike back to the base that night. And we were out here on this cold roads about 70 miles away from the base, hitchhiking with with no coats. And just so happened, some Marine pulls up, says, "You going to North Chicago?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "Get in." They gave us a ride all the way back.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the two biggest memorable experiences I had, both dealing with snow up there.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. And then when you finished Gunner's Mate School, where did you go from there?
Well, I went back to the reserve unit to get ready to go on active duty.
Mm-hmm.
I still hadn't even been on active duty yet. So I went back to the reserve unit for a couple of months and trained there at the reserve unit. I had so much time on my hands, I got myself a job and worked while I was waiting for active duty orders, which came in of September the next year.
Okay.
I finished Gunner's Mate A school in March of 68, and my orders finally came through in September of 68.
Okay.
And, September 68.
All right. In that time where you went back to the reserves, what type of training were they giving you there?
Well, at that time, I still was in they really didn't have much they could give me.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have two different units at that time, those that had been on active duty and those that hadn't been on active duty. So those of us that hadn't been on active duty, that we were going through the basic military stuff. Well, I'd been up in North Chicago at a naval base for the last, I think it was 8 months,
mm-hmm.
and had gone through all the military training that was necessary. So it was more of the same type of stuff. But what I did is I worked on, you have four things to advance in rank. One of them are practical factors. You have to be able to do certain types of operations in your job. Clean a gun, take a gun apart, you know, whatever your rate is. If your rate is as a corpsman, you have to be able to, you know, do different types of medical treatments.
Mm-hmm.
That's practical factors. Then you have military factors. You know, do you know how to salute the flag? Do you know how to come on board ship? Do you know how to do? It's much more difficult than that, but there's 50 to 100 items that you have to be able to do for your next rank.
Mm-hmm.
Then you take a test, which you have to pass, number one. You have to make at least a 70 on it. And then if they need 300 of those petty officers, of third-class petty officers, they need 300 of them. And 500 of you pass, they take the top 300 and you don't pass.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to study on that, and then you get your officers okay that you can be advanced in rank. So there's four things you have to do. And so what I did during that time is I just studied for the next rank. I had already made third class by that time, which was pretty much unheard of. Somebody hadn't even been on active duty was already third class petty officer.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just started studying for my second class test and worked on that.
Okay. All right. And when your orders finally came through, did that send you to Swift Boat School?
No, I had applied. When I was up in Gunner's Mate A school, my roommate had been sent to Swift Boat School, and he was really all excited about it. He had pictures of it and said it was a really great thing. So when I came back, it said, what do you want to do? You filled out what was called a dream sheet, and you
mm-hmm.
put down what you wanted to go do. And I said, I want to go to Swift Boats. And they said, you can't go to Swift Boats. You're too young. You're only 18. We can't send you to Swift Boat School.
Hmm.
And I said, okay, I want to be on a destroyer someplace.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so as it turned out, my orders were to a transit barracks on 32nd Street in San Diego, which meant that I was going to go there and sit and await orders because they didn't have anything. They didn't know where they want to put me yet.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got my orders, I didn't know where I was going, didn't know what was going to happen. So I packed up my stuff, said goodbye to everybody. And I just got married that summer, too. So I said goodbye to my wife, and we went and flew out to San Diego and told her that I didn't know what was going to happen, and went to the transit barracks. When I got to the transit barracks, they didn't have anything for me, but since I was already a petty officer, they made me master at arms of the transit barracks. So instead of being one of the members of the group sitting there waiting for orders, I was in charge of everything,
mm-hmm.
and which meant I had to get up every day, inspect everybody, make sure the barracks were clean, and keep order in our barracks. There was about 30 people in the barracks at that time.
Okay.
And I sat there, and I filled out another dream sheet, and this time I filled out the dream sheet, and I said I wanted to be on swift boats because by this time I turned 19. Mm-hmm. And they said, oh, you can't be on swift boats because you're married. What do you want to do? And I said, well, I want to be on a destroyer out of Hawaii. And they said, okay, we'll see what we can do about that. And so I waited around another 2 weeks, and all of a sudden I got my orders and said, swift boats, go to Coronado Island, transfer to Coronado Island last of September, and report for swift boat training.
Mm-hmm.
So even though they told me I couldn't do it two times, they finally just gave it to me anyway.
Okay.
And so I called my wife and told her that I was going to move over to Coronado, and I said, why don't you see if you can come out? I'm going to be there about 8 weeks. Why don't you see if you can fly out and stay with me? And so she had to drop out of school, which upset her father. He was dean of student personnel at Oklahoma State University at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was quite upset she was dropping out of school to come be with me, but she did.
Right.
And she flew out, and we got a little one-room, basically a one-bedroom apartment out there on the island, and started swift boat school.
Okay. Now, let's see. Can you, okay, I guess, tell me a little bit about the training, the swift boat school training?
Sure. We trained from, as a matter of fact, this last weekend, this last two days, this last week, when I was gone, I was up in Ohio meeting with a couple of guys. I was in swift boats. We have get-togethers all the time. And then in October, I'm going up for a big one in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
But we still get together quite a bit. But what swift boat school was at that time, I think it's eight full weeks,
mm-hmm.
which involved a tremendous amount of training. We had a series of boats there that were on a that were tied to causeway. This is now where all the SEALs were trained. The SEALs had just started. There still was Navy UDT, but this is the amphibious Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And we would start training at 7 o'clock in the morning and train all day long till usually 5 or 6 at night. And usually one or two days on the weekend we'd also train. And then we were off, and we could head for the beach. And like I said, my wife was there, and we had our apartment. There was a couple things that we could do there.
Mm-hmm.
But it would go at started from the very beginning. We went through boat operations, basically how the boat operated. It had two 12V71 diesel engines. You had to know how to operate the engines. It had an on-end generator that provided all the electricity, all the gun systems, the radar, the radio. All the deck operating systems, but each one of us was responsible for our job, plus you had to know a little bit about everybody else's job. It was the boat crew consisted of one officer, usually a Lieutenant JG,
mm-hmm.
And then five enlisted men, bosun mate for deck operations, a radio radarman who operated the radio and the radar, an engineman who took care of all the engines, a quartermaster, who did the navigating and usually drove the boat, and a gunner's mate who operated all the small arms. And we would go through, of course, since I'd been trained on all the big guns, I'd never even been trained on small arms, but I went through all the small arms school. I had to know how to take apart and fix 50 caliber machine guns, M60 machine guns, Russian AK-47s,
mm-hmm.
M79 grenade launchers. And our boat had something that the Army never could believe that we had, but we had an 81-millimeter mortar, which they sit in the ground and drop shells into and fire.
Mm-hmm.
But we had brought one up and connected it to a gun mount, put a recoil system on it and a trigger to where you could drop a mortar round down inside of it, point it at somebody, and shoot it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was quite an effective weapon. And then on top of that was a single 50-caliber machine gun. I was at the very top of the above the pilot house, 14 foot above sea level, and I had the twin 50 caliber machine guns, which was an old World War II B-52 mount.
Mm-hmm.
They pulled out of airplanes,
right.
Stuck on the top of the swift boat. The story behind the swift boat, and I'm getting off subject here, I'll get back.
No, that's perfectly fine.
The story of the swift boats is that in 1965, they needed a patrol boat in Vietnam right away.
Mm-hmm.
And so they came down, and Stewart Seacraft was building these crew boats for the offshore oil rigs. And they're just an ugly little old gray boat that a bunch of crew members could pile on. They could take it out from Louisiana and take it out and drop people off out in the off the offshore platforms.
Mm-hmm.
So the Navy took these, since they were already making them, already had the plans, and cut some large holes in them and made gun tubs, put guns on them, gun mounts, outfitted them with radio, radars, and large storage areas for ammunition,
mm-hmm.
and put in a refrigerator and a freezer and a Navy cook stove on the inside of it, one that when it's, everything snaps down, so if the boat rolls, the oven doesn't fall off and the pans, pots and pans don't fly out of it.
Right.
So they outfitted that and started sending them to Vietnam in 1965.
Okay.
For shore ocean patrol, offshore ocean patrol, not in the rivers.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where this came from. But back to a day in school, there was no typical day in school. You did boat operations, and then for 1 week we did water survival. And you'd go over and you'd swim and you'd swim and you'd swim, and they'd show you how to fight off attackers. And you did in the water martial arts, so to speak. We did a bunch of that type of stuff, which never came into play. We didn't get that close to them.
Right.
And we went through, you know, there's 100 snakes in Vietnam. 99 of them are deadly poisonous, and the other one can swallow you. So, you know, went through all these scare tactics, basically.
Right.
I saw one snake the whole year I was there.
Uh-huh.
They went through water survival in the ocean, what to do, this type of stuff. But very intense training. And our final exam was that you dove into this big pool with your full uniform on, boots, pants, shirt, hat, everything. And you swam around in a circle. And after about 15 minutes, your right arm's broken and hold it up in the air. So you had to hold your arm up in the air. Then you had to hold both arms up in the air and keep swimming.
Mm-hmm.
Then you had to hold one leg up in the air and keep swimming.
Wow.
Then you had to hold both feet out of the water and keep swimming. And then after about 45 minutes of this, three of them jumped into this group of 20 of us and tried to drown you. And you had to fight them off and get out. And if you were able to get away from them, and just get away from them, break one hole, then you'd pass the test and you could get out. We had at the water survival school, we had probably, four or five guys flunk. And basically, you didn't get flunked out. You just went back and had to do another week.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And they just roll you back. Then another week would be gunnery. And we'd go over every gun and how to take them apart, how to fix them, how to work with them, and then the final exam on that was that you were blindfolded and you were put in a barrel with the gun, and all the parts were dumped in on top of you,
mm-hmm.
and you had to, this 55-gallon drum, and then you had to find all the pieces and put the gun together before you could get out of the barrel.
Mm-hmm.
And they did that with us a couple of times. And then we went through many, many classes on radio and radar, seamanship, you know, map reading, Morse code. We had to learn Morse code. Then we also had Vietnamese classes at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So these things would rotate. You'd go for 3 or 4 hours to Vietnamese class, and you'd go for 2 or 3 hours on how to operate a radio. And then in the afternoon, you'd take the boats out.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody get on there, and you'd have to take the boat out from the pier without tearing the pier or the boat up, take it out in San Diego Harbor, do some type of little operation out there, and come back in and tie the boats back up, clean them up. And we did some operation on the boat every day up until the last week, where we went out and did, at this time the Navy was just doing board and search operations. So we had a couple of Vietnamese junks that were there. They were all painted up with a big eye on the front, and they'd have 2 or 3 guys in there dressed as Vietnamese, and we'd have to pull alongside of them and board and search them.
Right.
And one of the things that happened, there was one of the master chiefs there that was always trying to do something to throw you off, and he'd lose points and have to go back and go through another week. And one of the things he'd do is he'd throw a hand grenade, a fake hand grenade of something that he had in his hand, and if it landed inside your gun tub, you were dead,
mm-hmm.
and you lost points for that. And he was standing, I was watching him real closely, because what we'd do is you'd come up and it's my job to cover them with the twin 50 caliber machine guns. I keep the machine guns on the guy.
Mm-hmm.
And when we got too close to the boat, when we were tying up next to it, I had to bring the guns up and out of the way because they couldn't depress down enough to even shoot on the boat if we needed to, and pull my M16 out and hold my M16 ready to shoot in case something happened.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the chief was on the bow of the boat. And we were out of the harbor. We were out in the ocean. Big swells going on. And he lit a cigarette, and he had a real nice cigarette lighter. And he threw it at me, thinking it would land in the gun tub.
Mm-hmm.
And I just batted away with my hand out into the ocean. And he screamed and cursed at me for about 20 minutes right after that happened. But he shouldn't have thrown it.
Right.
But, we went out on those patrols, and then we went out on a long operation where we went all the way down to Mexico, and they had a towing sleeve where they towed behind a tugboat, an ocean-going tug. And we fired mortar rounds at it. We fired, had to fire 50 calibers, but unfortunately, about the time we got out there, a Mexican fishing boat was pulling up through our firing area, and we had to sit and wait. And the waves were just huge. They were giant swells coming through, and they were probably real slow, long period swells, so the boat would just rock like a bell.
Mm-hmm.
And after about 2 hours of this, people were just throwing up everywhere. And
right.
Our boat was rocking so far, it would rock over far enough that I could throw up without even having to get out of my gun tub and not even hit the boat.
Wow.
And so about the third time I threw up, the boat came righted itself up, and they said, "Okay, you're up, ready to fire." And I couldn't even see. I was just so hazy. And I said, "All right." And one of the things you're supposed to do on these towing sleeves is not hit it. You're supposed to shoot all around it, but you don't. They don't want you to hit it, because if you hit it, you'll damage it, and they can't tow it back.
Mm-hmm.
And as they pulled up there, I just shredded the thing. I couldn't even see where I was shooting.
Right.
And around, but we had to. I think the next boat fired after that, and there wasn't enough left of it that anybody else could fire.
Mm-hmm.
And we went, but that was the type of operation that was full gun. And then we went up to the other way we trained on weapons is we went up to Camp Pendleton,
mm-hmm.
the Marine base, and fired 81 millimeter mortars up there just to get used to it. They had one set on the back of a truck. And so they drive the truck real fast over bumpy roads, and you'd have to load and fire while they were doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, what else tell you about? Oh, one of the most interesting things that happened while we were there. One Sunday, we had to do boat operations, and the Sunday was December 7th.
Mm-hmm.
And we were on this pier, the Navy pier there in Coronado, and we were all standing at attention getting ready to go to our boats, and about this time, 30 Japanese Zeros flew in.
Mm.
What it was, North Island Naval Air Station was just to the north of us,
uh-huh.
and they had hired a bunch of the Navy pilots to fly Japanese Zeros for this new movie they were filming at the time called Tora, Tora, Tora.
Right.
So here comes these Japanese Zeros over the top of us. And so I went back home that night to talk to my wife, and I said, "Man, you wouldn't believe it." She said, "Japanese Zeros were flying over the top of us today." Yeah, I know. It felt like Pearl Harbor right there in San Diego.
Sure.
It was deja vu all over again.
Right.
But and they for the next couple of weeks they flew over us every day while they were training. But it just so happened that that the movie theater had hired a bunch of off duty naval pilots to fly them.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay, let me ask you about, you mentioned a little while ago that you were, one of the classes they were teaching here was Vietnamese. Were you able to pick up much of the language?
No, I didn't even pick it up when I got over there. We tried quite a bit, but basically we could tell them to stop, you know, get out of here, just very basic. I had probably a vocabulary of 30 or 40 words at the time.
Right.
That I could use, but nothing real. No conversation. We basically were just trying to get down, you know, put your gun down, stand up, put your hands over your head, get out of here, come to me, those type of commands.
Right.
To be able to command the boats whenever they were coming up. Supposedly we were supposed to have a Vietnamese interpreter on board, but that never never happened.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Would they also teach you anything about Vietnamese culture?
Oh, yes. Yes, we had, we not only that, well, as far as we had a couple of things, the Vietnamese culture. We also had Army culture, so to speak. We had liaisons from the Army and the Air Force that came in and talked about how the Army operated in Vietnam, order of battle, what a company was, what a battalion was, where they were operating, what they were trying to do. The Air Force did the same thing.
Right.
But a lot of Vietnamese culture on how to act towards the Vietnamese and how not to act and, you know, what not to do and that type of thing. But there was quite a bit of that.
Mm-hmm. Did you find this this training, this Vietnamese cultural training, did you find it useful for later?
Yeah, in a lot of ways it was. It helped out the Vietnamese language, but it was just a little bit more of, you know, understanding another country and how to deal whenever you got there, and not get yourself in trouble.
Right. Okay. What about your overall Swift Boat training? Did it prepare you for Vietnam?
Well, it prepared us as best you could. The mission, from the time that I was in school, starting about which was from September to January 1st, the mission in Vietnam changed completely. It went from offshore patrols to river patrols
right.
in the south. There were five divisions. So, yes, as far as boat operations, as far as how we operated the boats, how we operated guns, how we did all that, it prepared us. As far as how to operate in the rivers, no, it didn't. But we were not the first, but we were probably the second tier of people that started running rivers. Bernique started running rivers in Antoy in about October, about November. And Larry Thurlow, who is a boat officer, he was one of the ones also started running rivers about that same time. He lives up in Bogue, Kansas. So they started this, and when we went over, we picked it up very shortly after they started it. And I guess you could say it was all learned. Now, they have a group of people called Special Warfare Combat Crewmen now in the Navy. It's actually a rate that you can get. And we were the very first ones of those. We got those awarded just a year ago, as a matter of fact, as being the very first combat crewman the Navy ever had. But we learned everything on the job training. But these guys go through a year's worth of training on how to operate in rivers and close combat situations. We got none of that.
Right.
We were just thrown into it. As a matter of fact, they've got one of our boats there in Coronado up as a memorial. I was out there to see it a couple of years ago. But the Special Warfare Combat Crewman is kind of like the paratrooper's badge. It's a metal badge that goes on the uniform, or a submariner's badge. And the Navy was nice enough to come back and say, well, you guys were the first ones of these, so we're going to grandfather you in, and they sent us the award and a nice little certificate a couple of years after that. But in answer to your question, we knew how to operate the boat. The nice thing about it is we worked with our same crew that we went over with.
Okay.
They didn't mix us. Now, a couple of crews had to be mixed, but we were lucky enough to go with the same guys that we trained with.
Okay. All right. What about your instructors here? Were they combat veterans from Vietnam? Or?
They were all swift boat veterans from Vietnam. They might not have been combat veterans, but
right.
they all had operated on swift boats offshore Vietnam at that time. The commanding officer was a full lieutenant of the group, and he had been on swift boats, one of the very first ones over there. And all the chiefs and the petty officers were also swift boat veterans. And they were the ones that were telling us, well, you know, we hear they're starting to go into rivers now. So the training changed dramatically over the next year.
Right.
For the guys coming through the schools after us.
Okay. All right. Did they ever talk much about their experiences?
Oh yeah, but their experiences were
different.
Were board and search junks, and there's lots of board and search every junk out there, which means that you're hassling every poor guy that's trying to catch fish out in the water. You're not the Viet Cong aren't going to be stupid enough to be out there. You'd board and search all these guys in boats and everything else, trying to find weapons and everything else.
Right.
At this time, two of the people, and as a matter of fact, one here lives here in Houston, before they started going to the rivers, were up in the northern part of the area, and they were trying to bring down these big trawlers. China would give them a trawler, and they'd load that sucker up with all the weapons they could, and they'd run it down the coast and then run it in the ground and dump all the weapons off to the VC or the NVA, whoever was there.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy here, matter of fact, he lives just a couple miles from me, he was on the boat that actually sunk one of the trawlers.
Mm-hmm.
With 81 millimeter mortar. They were in quite a bit of, they got their boat just riddled with bullets. And then another guy that lives up, can't think of the name, northeast of Houston, he actually was on boats that sunk two trawlers.
Okay.
Which was the biggest combat, the biggest and only combat I think swift boats had had by that time.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Which was pretty big because they were going up against ships that were 10 times their size.
Sure. All right. Did you come to know these guys that participated in this later on, or?
Yeah, those guys I really didn't talk to until we had our big Swift reunion a couple of years ago.
Okay.
And got to know them, found out they just lived real close to me.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I did not know them at the time.
Okay. All right. And when did you realize that, or when did you come to know that that the training they had given you was not what you were going to be doing?
They pretty much told us that there.
Okay.
They told us that, you know, you're going to be, said some of you, well, here's what it was. There's five divisions in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
The first one at Antoy is Division 11, which is the far south, as far south as you can go, and is the Cao Mau Peninsula. That's where all the combat was going on. That's where all the river patrols were going on. The next one was up at Cat Low, and there was some river patrol going on up in there. And then the ones to the north, Cameron, Nha Trang, and Qua Viet, they didn't have any river patrols at that time. Now, Qua Viet started some, but there really wasn't any rivers at Nha Trang or Cameron to go into.
Okay.
Large bay. So those basically remained fairly safe areas. So at the time that we were getting ready to go over, the bloody place was Antoy. As a matter of fact, the way when we got in country, we flew into Cameron Bay, and I went over to the Enlisted Men's Club and started having a couple of drinks with some guys that just got back from there. And from the way they talked, every afternoon they were getting out the fire hoses and washing the blood and guts off the causeway. So I wasn't too excited about it at that time.
Right.
Because we sent six boat crews over at the time that I went over, and we were the first six boat crews to go over in almost a half a year.
Mm-hmm.
They hadn't had any replacements at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were the senior crew, which meant we had, our officer was senior to all, so we were the ones going to Antoy. The other ones were going to the safer areas.
Right.
So it was the most, I think the scaredest I ever was finding out I was going to Antoy and then having to listen to stories about it for 5 days before I actually got there.
Sure.
As with most things, it wasn't nearly as bad as what you thought it was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
It was bad, but it wasn't just absolutely horrible.
Okay. All right. Before we move into your Vietnam experience and your orders to go to Vietnam, when you finished up Swift Boat School, did you receive your orders to go to Vietnam then, or was there?
We were going to Vietnam.
Right.
Yes, we basically had our orders to go to Vietnam, but directly where we were going to, yes, we got them at the very end.
Okay. All right. And did you have any time at all in between to any off time before shipping out?
Yeah, we had what they told us was that, well, I'll tell you what happened, and we also had to go to SEER school.
Okay.
5 days up in Woodbee Island, Washington, in the middle of winter, where you go out and they teach you how to survive in the woods, how to cook a rabbit, and then they chase you around through the woods and they put you in a prisoner of war camp and beat on you and scream at you and go through horrendous, they actually put you in a pit, put you in a box and screw the box down on you until the next morning when they turn around and tell you stand at attention, they raise an American flag, people start crying.
Mm-hmm.
It was that I mean, you actually thought you were in a prisoner of war camp. It was a horrendous deal. All the boat crew had to go to it, except for me and my bosun mate. And what happened on that was that we both had wives there, and they told us that we were leaving Monday morning to go to SEER school.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to be there at 0500 in the morning with our greens on, and they were taking us up to Whidbey Island. And so we went and talked to our leading petty officer, and we said, hey, we want to take our wives up to Los Angeles and drop them off at this guy's house. His mother lived up there, his friend of mine,
mm-hmm.
because my wife was 18 years old, and I really didn't want to be there for a week by herself.
Right.
Out in California. So he said, oh, go ahead and take off. There's only an hour more class. So we hop in the car, and we drive to Los Angeles. We spend the weekend there, go to Disneyland, have a good weekend, and turn around and travel back and put on our green uniform, show up at 0500 hours ready to catch the plane,
mm-hmm.
and there's nobody else there.
Hmm.
And so we walk over, and they said, oh, yeah, they changed their orders. They got a plane in early. They left out Saturday morning. And so I said, oh, God, we're going to prison. So the guy says, what do we need to do? I said, let's go home and get our dress blues on and come back and turn ourselves in.
Mm-hmm.
So we hopped in his car, went back, got our dress blues on, went back, and went up and turned ourselves in for a captain's mask.
Mm-hmm.
And said, we missed ship's movement, which is usually 30 days in the brig.
Right.
And they said, all right, you guys are going to be punished. What you got to do is you got to stand guard duty for the next week.
Uh-huh.
Oh, okay. So we go up there. They said, report up to the main guard station. And so we go up to the main guard station. They said, oh, you got to get some white spats to go on your uniform. You got to get a white belt and a gun.
Uh-huh.
So I guess we went over and got that. Came back and said, okay, you've got to stand guard duty from 0800 to 1200 on Wednesday. Oh, okay. So we took off the rest of the week. Came back for that 1 4-hour stint. That was our whole punishment.
Oh, wow.
And so anyway, but then they told us, well, you have to go to SEER school. So our, and I'm getting back to what happened in between.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't go off with your crew. And so we went over, that's what the officer told us. So we went over to the yeoman, which was enlisted man. We said, hey, look, we really want to get out of here. We don't want to stay around here and go to SEER school. He said, our crew is already gone.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not going to be with them. We're going to have to get with another crew if we have to stay here for a couple of weeks and go to SEER school. He said, oh, hell. So he writes out, been to SEER school, stamped it, said, go ahead and get out of here. So at that point, they told us, they came and they assembled us up. They gave us money to fly to Seattle, Washington
mm-hmm.
On commercial flights and told us to be there in 5 days. Well, I had already shipped my wife home. She had left her off the airport the day before, crying,
right,
and shipped all the stuff home. Of course, she had the flu, which was another unfortunate incident because I got it from her later. So I said, well, shit, I'm going to go back to Oklahoma. So I took the ticket money, went over to the airport, and I said, I want to get a flight from here to Oklahoma City and then from Oklahoma City to Seattle, Washington. And it covered it. The money that the Navy gave me covered all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I hopped on this flight, and when I got on the flight, this time people were being a little bit nicer to military people. So the guy sitting next to me just kept buying me drinks the whole flight. This was back when they would do that on the plane. So when I got to Oklahoma City, I was just screaming drunk. I couldn't even hardly stand up. And so I went out there and I had my duffel bag to go to Vietnam. And I was in my uniform. And this is in Oklahoma City. Stillwater's about 60 miles away, and I just walked outside and I said, I want to go to Oklahoma. I want to go to Stillwater. How much is it going to cost? He said, oh, $50. I said, let's go.
Right.
So I took a cab from Oklahoma City Airport to Stillwater
mm-hmm.
and showed up at my father-in-law's house, which is out in the middle of the country, at 3:30 in the morning and knocking on the door. And, of course, he didn't like me anyway.
Right.
But, he comes to the door and he said, oh, I thought it was some drunk. Said, and it is. I said, well, damn. So anyway, I got to spend a couple of days, see my mom, my dad, my brother and sister, and see everybody there at home.
Mm-hmm.
So I got about a 5-day basket leave, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And then took off, jumped on the plane, and flew to Seattle, to McChord Air Force Base, to catch our military flight over to Vietnam.
Okay. right. What did your how did your family react? What did they think about you getting your orders to Vietnam?
Well, they were rather upset about it, but they were very proud. My dad being a World War II veteran and everything, they'd been through it.
Mm-hmm.
But they basically didn't say much of anything about it.
Okay.
More worried than anything else.
Right. Did your dad talk to you? Did he give you any advice or anything?
Oh, no.
Okay.
Not at all.
Okay. All right. So then you left the U.S. to go to Vietnam from you said Washington?
Yeah, McCord Air Force.
McCord Air Force Base.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. And you said you flew by commercial airliner,
commercial
right?
There and back, both. They didn't have enough military planes to do it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you have any stopovers on the way?
On the way, we stopped in Kodo, Japan,
mm-hmm.
and they refueled, and it was just miserably cold. But I had caught the flu for my wife, and I was starting to get really sick.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a rough flight, to say the least.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, had you caught up with the guys in your crew? Were they on the same flight?
No, they weren't, because they had gone on one before.
Okay.
And we met up in Cameron Bay.
Mm-hmm.
We met up at Cameron Bay, and at the EM Club, and then from there we took a flight from there to Saigon. And in Saigon, we stayed at a hotel,
mm-hmm.
and they told us that we were flying out the next day at 5 o'clock. We had to be out down at the lobby at 5 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And just as soon as we were getting ready to go to bed, they came back and said, "Oh, no, those have been canceled. You're not leaving at 5 o'clock in the morning, so just go ahead and sleep in." Well, the next morning, some guy came by on a motorcycle and threw a satchel charge into the group of people that were standing there waiting for the bus that we were supposed to be there.
Oh, wow.
And killed four of them.
Mm.
So that's one of many instances that happened to us where something just happened and the people that were where we were supposed to be died and we didn't.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh.
Sorry. Well, how long were you in Cameron Bay?
I was in Cameron Bay 3 or 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure.
What were you doing during this time?
Well, we were just waiting to catch a plane out of there, but I was laying in bed throwing up.
Right, because you...
I was just deathly ill, and there was no medical service at all, so I couldn't get to a medic and get any help whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
So I was... I just laid in bed. And when I did get up, it was usually in the evening, and the only place to go was the EM Club, and I'd end up having two or three drinks, which is really stupid. And basically, I had crackers and rum for 3 days
right.
while I was sober, while I was trying to get through the flu.
Mm-hmm. Right. Was there any type of end processing?
End process? There probably was, but I wasn't aware of it.
Right.
We just handed our orders, and they told us to go wait.
Mm-hmm.
But no, there wasn't any in process.
Okay.
Not there. It was later on down in Antoine.
Mm-hmm. And so after 3 or 4 days, you then flew down to Saigon, right?
Flew down to Saigon, spent a day there, and then flew on out to Antoy.
Okay.
On a military plane.
Had you recovered by this time from the flu?
I was getting over it by this
mm-hmm.
time. I was fine.
Okay. Did you have? I know you were sick at this time, but did you have any? What do you remember about your initial thoughts about Vietnam? Your first impressions about Vietnam at that time?
It was hot and humid,
mm-hmm.
and of course it was. I was never off a military base during that time.
Uh-huh.
The naval base at Cameron Bay is surrounded by the Army base, which is surrounded by the Air Force base, which is surrounded by the Army base. So. About as safe as you could be.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually a very gorgeous place. As a matter of fact, I talked about later that, you know, if you went back there, it'd be a great place to put a hotel. White sand beaches and just gorgeous mountains and really a gorgeous little place.
Mm-hmm.
And but it was hot, it was humid, I was sick. away from home.
Right.
Wanted to go home. Knew that I was going to die because, like I said, all the stories we heard in the EM Club, basically it was, you know, at the end of the day, they just hose you off the deck. So it was a pretty rough time right there, those couple of days.
Sure. Okay. Well, could you describe Antoy for me?
Yeah. Antoy is an island off the west coast of Vietnam, which if you take that Parrot's Beak that comes down into the ocean,
mm-hmm.
There's several islands that surround it. Antoy is a fairly good-sized island between Thailand and Vietnam. As a matter of fact, the border that cuts north of there is Thailand, Cambodia, and Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting part, Joseph Conrad, who was a writer in the late 1800s,
right.
If you're familiar with his work, wrote about this whole area and the islands.
Okay.
But he was on a sailing ship at the time. When I read his book while I was over there, which is really interesting. But Antoy was a large island. We had the south tip of it. We had a small base there. The VC had about 300 to 400 men on the island creating havoc, and we basically held the south tip. There was a Coast Guard base, a Vietnamese RAG base, which are the Vietnamese junk navy, and then we were stationed off. We were not on land. We had an Apple, APL, which is a World War II barrack ship. It's not a ship. Doesn't have a name. It's just called the APL and had some number.
Okay.
But no name because it didn't have any engines.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a three-story barracks with mess facilities. And then tied along to that was the USS Krishna, which was a tender. And the Krishna was a tender to the swift boats. Then tied on the one side or the other, either on the APL or on the Krishna side. Krishna side, if you were getting repairs, you were tied up over there. But if you're just in port, you were tied up on the Apple side. And we had our nest of swift boats, and there'd be anywhere from 3 to 10 swift boats tied up there at a time who weren't on patrol.
Mm-hmm.
And the Apple was like I said, it was just, if you can imagine, staying on an old ship, the World War II class, that was always in need of paint and repair,
mm-hmm.
and never had fresh water. And we had salt water showers. Just a pretty rough place to live.
Okay. All right. And you were assigned to the parent unit was it CTF-115?
CTF-115.
Okay.
Was the big overall unit that was commanded by at that time. Admiral Roy Hoffman,
mm-hmm.
or actually, it was Captain Roy Hoffman at the time. Then there were, and he was in. That was all the boats. Then we were under that. It was Cosron One, which is the headquarters at Cameron Bay, which was all the Swift divisions. Then under that, there were 5 Swift divisions, and we were Coastal Division 11 out of Antoy,
mm-hmm.
which took everything from the Cambodian border on the west side all the way around and all the way up to near Cat Lo, which is the entrance to the Mekong River.
Okay. All right. And what was the overall role of CTF 115?
I hate to say it. My understanding of everything for CTF 115 was protection and of all the rivers, bays, and offshore Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
to interdict all the to interdict the VC and stop the enemy in it any place that we could.
Right. Okay. And the role of your particular Swift boat division within that?
Our division had responsibility for the area I told you about, all the way from the Cambodian border, which is the Ha Tien River.
Right.
Up at near Rockjaw, just north of Rockjaw a little ways, all the way around up not to the Mekong River, but to the last river, which is the Song Bo Di,
mm-hmm.
On the east side, which
okay.
is a river that flows in and out. This area, that if you've got a map there, it's kind of a Parrot's Beak looking thing that goes down to the ocean.
Right.
It's intertidal rivers, which means that if the tide goes in and the tide goes out, the rivers change depth.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably a meso to microtidal system. I didn't know this at the time. I do now. I'm a geologist, but the river would, the river could go out and leave you stranded if you were up in it.
Mm-hmm.
If the tides went out far enough. The extremely muddy, nothing above 3 meters, just as flat as the Texas coastal plains, mud flats.
Okay.
And lots and lots of vegetation. However, this is the area where they sprayed on top of us many times massive amounts of Agent Orange. If you look at, there's a military book that I found in the Oklahoma State Library a couple years ago that showed all the ranges that they dropped Agent Orange on down in this part of it. And it's all over the areas that we operated. Just absolutely covered the area. And we'd go into areas there wouldn't be any vegetation at all. Just everything was dead.
Right.
Trying to run that out. It was I want to jump around here a little bit. The island I've talked about, Antoy Island, if you see it on a map there, if you'll notice the very top north section is kind of a carved out half moon.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of our patrol areas. We would go up there and anchor and run radar all night long to make sure they weren't bringing any trawlers down from Cambodia, make sure anybody was trying to slip across the top. That was one of the most beautiful areas I've ever seen in my life. There's a small mountain range at that north end of that island.
Mm-hmm.
We'd anchor out in this absolutely gorgeous bay, cook a couple of steaks.
Uh-huh.
Two or three of us would stay on duty, watch the radar, you know, look through the binoculars, and just have the most peaceful, wonderful patrol you could ever have.
Right.
Which was a real rarity. I think we got to do that 3 times.
Mm.
So it wasn't often, but it was just a real gorgeous place.
Okay. All right. One of the things I wanted to ask you about Antoy, as far as the base there, did you mentioned VC being on the island. Did the base ever come under attack?
Not while I was there.
Okay.
It did come under attack at other times, but not while I was there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Also, you talking about Agent Orange, did you or anyone else in your crew or you know about have any effects from it?
No, I don't believe we did.
Okay.
Yeah, and I don't think any. And I know all. I still keep in contact with all but one crew member.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know where he is. So.
Okay. All right. Well, could you take me through a typical day, if there was such a thing?
I'm going to take you through because it changes.
Okay.
Now, we were lucky enough, and I still see these people, and it's real funny because you see them now, and they don't look, they just look grayer, but a lot of them look exactly like they did back then.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, we did is that we went up and met the commanding officer and got a bunch of information on where the VC was operating. Of course, all this stuff went over my head. I was just trying to run the guns. But they threw a lot of information at us the first day. We went up and talked to the operations officer and the had some type of CIA intelligence guy there that was telling us what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went to a place called Ha Tien, which is it's a river that runs between Cambodia and Vietnam, right on that upper border.
Mm-hmm.
For a training patrol. And the best way I can describe this is it was kind of like the VC and us decided that if we would both operate in the area, but we wouldn't shoot at each other, we'd use it as a training area. And they train their people there, and we train our people. So we were never shot at on the river at all when I was there. But we did about 2 weeks of where we'd go up there and make two or three patrols in, usually during the day or late in the evening, early in the morning, not at night. And there's a little village there. The village is Ha Tien. They had some of the absolute best shrimp that you ever taste in your life. It was sold in a place called the Ha Tien Photo Shop. He didn't sell photographs or cameras or anything. but the Hatian Photoshop served beer and shrimp. And he was, as a matter of fact, he was the guy that served us there. As soon as we pulled out and the VC took it over, they hung him right there at the causeway where we were. But we would go in there, and it was the first time I'd ever been served Vietnamese beer, and they would bring the ice in, which was packed in sawdust. So you'd have sawdust all over your ice. You'd pour your beer over it, and the sawdust would float, maybe two or three flies that came out of the bottle. And the beer was Bamui Ba, or 33 beer.
Right.
And we'd have a beer or two when we weren't on patrol.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would head on upriver. And what we do is everybody would be at battle stations, which in the very forward part was our radar man with a M60 machine gun sitting down in the peak tank. So he's basically below the water line, the very bow of the boat with his machine gun. Then there was a quartermaster in the either the left or the right hatchway to the pilot house with a M16 rifle, and then I would be up with my twin 50s, and then behind me on the fantail would be the usually the engineman and the bosun mate, and they would operate the 50 caliber machine gun and a Honeywell grenade launcher.
Mm-hmm.
And then what we do is we'd go into the river, everybody in flat gear and helmets. The trouble was they didn't have enough flat gear and helmets. So some of us didn't have one. I had a helmet, but I didn't have a flak jacket.
Hmm.
We also didn't have any green uniforms, so we were having to wear our Navy dungarees, which stuck out like a sore thumb.
Right.
They just didn't have any. We couldn't get equipment at all. We had to steal machine gun parts off of helicopters when they'd land. We did that quite often.
Right.
But we would, and then we'd go up the river. We'd patrol in two or three boats together. Sometimes as many as five, and we'd make a run up the river, checking everything out, and turn around and come back.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we did on training patrols. And the guy who was our training officer at the time still talked to him.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I didn't talk to him back then because he was an officer and I was an enlisted man. We didn't run around together.
Right.
But we did that for a couple of weeks, and then we got thrown into the rivers down south where all the action was going on. And they had several down there, the Bodie River, the Kulon River, and the Sonadoc. The Sonadoc was a really wild one. And the first time we were ever shot at, we were making a run into the Sonadoc, and all of a sudden, boom, the whole side of the boat just blew in, and we took a rocket right on the starboard side.
Mm-hmm.
And we started firing and getting out, and the engineman started trying to patch the hole, and we had water coming in, and luckily it was just above the water line, so we didn't have to sink, but they started putting patches on it. And then another boat came around and took a look at the hole and saw how big it was and said we had to get out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And as we were getting out, as we went in, you didn't see anything. If you could imagine a muddy river and then rice fields, and you know, I was quite pretty.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just about sunset, and all of a sudden on the way out, there were probably 10 Viet Cong flags that had been on flagpoles that they'd raised to let us know that they were there.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd get fire through in there, and then we got out towards the mouth of the river, and all of a sudden started getting machine gun fire.
Right.
And didn't realize what it was because it was so far away, but I was sitting up here in the top, and I started hearing all these bees buzz around my head. And it's just this buzz, buzz.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, what is that? Because I couldn't see any bees. And then all of a sudden I realized that someone was trying to kill me.
Right.
And I mean, not trying to kill us, but trying to kill me. He was shooting directly at me.
Mm-hmm.
But the bullets were just going all around me. And it was, but they were evidently so far out that they'd started tumbling through the air.
Right.
And there was this buzz, and it was just, I mean, right next to him. Then they started slapping into the gun tub that I was in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's whenever I ducked down.
Right.
And quit taking pictures. But that was the first time I ever remember being shot at.
Okay.
Actually. And the one thing that I could think of was just real funny because, you know, people are out there, they're trying to kill you. When I say that, they're trying to kill anybody that they can.
Mm-hmm.
But this guy was trying to kill me. I mean, he was trying to shoot me.
Right.
And it was just this really strange feeling that, shit, he can't be doing that.
Right. Sure.
And that was the first time we were hit really bad.
Mm-hmm.
And then a typical day, we would go, and this changed dramatically. We would go on patrol. We'd usually have two or three 24-hour patrol. We'd go out, and we might hit the rivers for 24 hours. And, I mean, we'd go into them and out of them, anchor in them at night, try to ambush, try to draw fire. And then the second we drew fire, we'd have a firefight, and we'd call in helicopters or anybody else that we could. Sometimes we could call it. We were so far out of range of everybody, sometimes we couldn't get any air support at all.
Mm-hmm.
So it was almost like the Lone Ranger type thing. We were out there, and sometimes we got help, sometimes we didn't.
Right.
So, and then we'd pull out, and we'd go back, and we'd clean the boats, bring up, put in new ammunition, refuel, and get ready for our next mission. Then we'd usually have a good night's sleep and get a hot meal, and then we'd head out for another 24-hour patrol. When they opened up the rivers down south, we started going way down south there, and they put another, they put an LST down there,
mm-hmm.
Westchester County.
Okay.
And we would live on the Westchester County, and we would go in the rivers, and we would transfer down there, and basically we left our home base on the Apple, all our clothes and everything else, and went down there and spent 45 days.
Mm-hmm.
And we were going in rivers every day, just one right after another.
Right.
And the Westchester County treated, of course, they were Navy, but they didn't treat us very well. And during that time, they got transferred out, and a Coast Guard cutter took their place.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first Coast Guard cutter that had been brought to Vietnam. It was a rather large one. And they were really nice because they were just excited to be there. So we would pull up. We'd pull up to the Navy ship. They would drop a refueler down, and we'd refuel, and they'd drop ammunition down. We'd bring ammunition. We'd run alongside the Coast Guard cutter. They jumped on board, and they said, "You guys go up and watch a movie and eat. We're going to take care of your boat for us." And they cleaned the boat, rearmed us, refueled us,
mm-hmm.
fixed everything we had, and then, I mean, just treated us like royalty.
Right.
Absolutely wonderful.
Right.
And but if we were alongside a Navy ship, they just treated us like crap. So they didn't care. Oh, one of the funniest things that happened was we had a guy, you know, I was telling you about people that dropped out of Swift School. We had this poor guy. He was a bosun mate at Swift Boat School, and he was just totally clumsy, and he stuttered. He shouldn't have been in the Navy,
mm-hmm.
but he was. He went over to buy something at the Naval Exchange, and one of the young ladies there that was trying to sell him stuff and kept saying, "Well, what do you want? What do you want?" And he finally just got so frustrated, he said, "Well, fuck you." And so they kicked him out of Swift School and sent him to sleep.
Right.
Well, we pull up alongside the Westchester County to get ammunition for the first time, and they put 50 caliber ammunition, which I reloaded,
mm-hmm.
in great big, large gray canisters that weighed about 85 pounds.
Uh-huh.
And when you pull up alongside the LST, you're down in a 50-foot boat, and the deck above you is probably 35 foot above you.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked up there, and he goes, "Hey, Gunner!" And I said, "Oh my God, this was his bosun mate, you know,
right.
just been who I hadn't seen since he got kicked out of school." I said, "Hey, how you doing?" He says, "Fine." He says, need some ammunition." I said, "Yeah." So he takes the ammunition, he ties it on, he lowers this thing over, and the knot comes undone, and this thing crashes to the deck and puts a huge dent in our deck.
Oh God.
And he just, there were three of us there, and he could have killed either one of us.
Goodness.
But that was more than exciting to see him again, to say the least.
Sure.
And but then back to operations. Then we brought in Operation Seafloat. I don't know if you know anything about Seafloat.
Mm-mm. No, sir.
Operation Seafloat was a series of barges that they put up the... I can't reach the name of it, the Kulon River.
Okay.
And it was right next to Nam Can City, which is a city of 150,000 that was completely wiped out during Tet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not everybody was killed, but basically they wiped the city off the face of the earth. And there was this huge, giant area that there was nothing but rubble
mm-hmm.
that we'd go by. And we were patrolling it. There was only three or four boats that actually patrolled this area that were fighting the BC down there at the time.
Right.
Well, they decided in this Operation Sea Lords to bring down this big barge, set it in the middle of the river, make complete operations out of it, bring in all sorts of boats. We had rag boats and just army boats were down there. They had everything in the world operating all of a sudden the last couple of months we were there. And it just became a big, huge base that operated out of the river and operated there 24 hours a day, trying to track down all the VC that we could.
Right.
And let's see, another thing on the operation, you're supposed to only stay there in this bad area about 4 months and then get rotated out when a new crew would come in.
Mm-hmm.
And the crew that came in, we were finally supposed to be rotated out, and this crew came in to take our place.
Mm-hmm.
So we took them on a couple of training missions, and bam, the first time out, three of them were killed.
Mm-hmm.
So they transferred everybody else out, brought in another crew, and this happened for almost 5 months. Every time they bring a crew in to replace us, two or three of them would be wounded horribly or killed.
Mm-hmm.
And so we ended up staying in where we were for almost a full 8 months.
Mm-hmm.
We had the longest time in the rivers than anybody there, our 93 boat crew. We were on PCF 93.
Okay. Wow. Okay. Could you, you mentioned going into the rivers basically every day, and how often during these times would you have contact with the enemy?
Our boat had contact with the enemy at least once a week.
At least once a week.
If not more.
Okay.
Probably never go. We might go in and spend three full days and never sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Went 72 hours once without any sleep, running up and down the rivers. We only had about 24 hours worth of fuel on board, so you know, you dock and you just run it into the ground and sit there and try to set up an ambush for several hours,
mm-hmm.
usually at night. And but we would have some type of contact at least once a week, either a small quick firefight or a mine blow up.
Mm-hmm.
This guy that I just visited in Ohio was in the. This is I was telling you about. My boat officer, Jack Chenoweth,
mm-hmm.
and I went up to visit Dick Pease, who's up in Ohio.
Okay.
Well, Dick Pease is the three boat that blew up when John Kerry claimed that he got his Purple Heart,
mm-hmm.
although he was on the other side of the river.
Right.
We were going up, and these four boats went into the river, and our boat had been cash ripped, so we couldn't get our engines going, so they moved us to another boat. So we got started late, so we had to go into the river and meet them by ourselves, which is just, you're not supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
So we went running up this river by ourselves, just knowing we were going to be annihilated. And we got it, we made up with the other group and stayed at the village there for a little while and then turned around to come back out. And we were supposed to be lead boat. Well, Dick P's boat, the three boat, took the lead.
Mm-hmm.
And as he's going out of the river, we come up to a fishing weir, which is stretched across the river. There's a space on each side.
Okay.
Well, we were supposed to be lead, but somehow Dick P's boat gets ahead of us. So it's his boat, then our boat. Then on the other side is John Kerry's boat, the 43 boat. And then behind us is the 56 boat, which is commanded by Larry Thurlow.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm looking up there, and all of a sudden this boat just rises straight up in the water. And this thing's, I don't know, it's a 150-ton boat.
Right.
It's huge. But this mine goes off, and this boat goes, I mean, just 6 to 10 foot in the air,
mm-hmm.
slams back down, and people go flying off of it. And a real good friend of mine was in the gun tub, and he just disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he was dead.
Right.
And so I start firing over on one side, and Thurlow's boat comes around us and starts picking up the guys out of the water, and he goes on board to try to save the guys on the three boat that was blown up, and everybody's just knocked senseless,
mm-hmm.
basically. Kerry's boat starts up, he leaves the kill zone, just starts firing like a wild man, shooting at everything. I shut down my guns, the other boat shut down their guns because we aren't getting any return fire. It's basically just one guy sitting in a hole,
mm-hmm.
and he put some wires together and blew up the three boat. Anyway, we spent an hour in there getting the three boat all ready to go out. Hook up to it. Our boat, again, has to go out by itself, go out, and the LST has sent a couple of damage control experts and a pump in so we can pump the boat out and get it out because it's just sinking in the water.
Mm.
So our boat goes out by itself, picks up all the stuff, receives no fire, gets the pump, gets these two guys on board, and they're wanting to, we got to have flak jackets, we got to have flak jackets. Says, well, we don't have any anyway, don't worry about it.
Right.
They're just hot. You don't need to wear one.
Right.
So we go back in and pump out the three boat and carry it on out. But the interesting thing of that story is, other than the fact that I was with two of those guys this weekend,
okay,
this last week.
All right.
And that would be some of the big contact. The other time, the biggest firefight I was ever in was when the 43 boat was destroyed and most of the people on board were killed.
Mm-hmm.
We were again supposed to be we were going into the Sambodi River, and we had a big operation going. They put this Coast Guard commander in charge, which I never understood why they did this, because the guy had no tactical experience at all.
Right.
He later became commandant of the Coast Guard, which amazed me, because he was a total moron. His call sign was Dipsy Doodle, which tell you quite a bit about him.
Right.
But we were six, seven. I want to say 13. There were two groups of boats, I think five and six. I think there was 11 boats going in. We were in the first group, and we were not only in the first group, but we were the lead boat.
Mm.
So we start into this thing, and we know there's a lot of VC in here. We'd heard about them, and also some NVA. So we were going on in. We knew we were going to catch it. We knew our boat was going to just get blown to smithereens. And I just felt like my number was up.
Right.
And we go in, and the Coast Guard commander who's in the boats behind says, pull over, pull over. So we pull over, and we were making this leapfrog jump where we would go in a certain distance, and they'd leapfrog, set up a base, and we'd leapfrog, and we'd just keep moving in the river this way till we found them.
Mm-hmm.
So we pulled over at this river bend, and they take off. And just as the last boat rounds the corner, the boat position that we should have been in takes two rockets in the side, goes in, and kills everybody in the pilot house, and the boat just goes flying up onto the... I didn't see any of this. It was around the bend.
Mm-hmm.
I heard it from eyewitnesses later. Goes flying up and lands right in front of the machine gun nest,
mm-hmm.
the VC. And the guys that were on there had to fight their way back off the back of the boat and were fighting within 5, 10, 15 foot of where these VC were.
Oh, wow.
The boats came in there, killed all those guys, pulled our guys off the boats, and pulled all the dead and wounded off,
mm-hmm.
got out of there, and all hell's breaking loose. We don't have any helicopters in the air. There's firing going on. And so we start off to go save them, and then we're ordered back, you know,
right.
stay back. Not by the Coast Guard officer, but by Latch, who's overall operations back at the main boat.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we had to end up destroying the 43 boat. Brought in a helicopter, finally came in, and we destroyed it ourselves so the VC couldn't get anything off of it. They did, however, get the machine guns off of it, which later killed a good friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
But they stole two or three guns off, captured two or three guns off of the boat, and got to the bushes with it.
Right.
Anyway, we were there all night long, just being mortared by the VC. Just mortar rounds were just coming, falling between our boats, but we stayed there all night long and couldn't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Next day we went up, and I've got some pictures of the boat, what was left of it, and the battlefield of the area. But that was the worst thing. That firefight went on all night long, from dawn, from dusk to dawn the next day.
All right.
I'm losing you here. Just a minute.
Okay.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. I can hear you fine.
Okay. Can't hear you at all.
Okay.
Oh, there you go. You're back.
Let me see if I can adjust this patch real quick to where it's a little bit louder on my end.
Okay.
But you can hear me fine now?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Would the contact always come from the shoreline, or the VC ever in boats themselves?
No, they weren't. They were once, but it was a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
We rounded a bend one time, and usually you could hear us coming from miles, but we rounded a bend one time, and there was a boat full of them,
mm-hmm.
With a big VC flag over the top of them. And when they saw us come around the corner, I got ready to unload on them, and man, the hands went up, and all the guns went in the water,
mm-hmm.
and we just took them prisoner.
Right.
Okay. But no, they they would dig spider holes. See, they were really smart. Got to give them that. They would dig these spider holes, mm-hmm. and they would launch a rocket or set off a mine in the water, or just, you know, level a machine gun right through the middle of us,
mm-hmm.
and then they'd go down the spider holes.
Right.
So what we would do is we got some Honeywell grenade launchers, which is just nothing more than a machine gun that fires grenades.
Okay.
And we would just cover the whole area with hand grenades,
mm-hmm.
and try to get them that way. But they would change their tactics almost immediately,
mm-hmm.
when anything happened. They were quite smart, quite good. Once we'd take a bunch of them out, they'd figure out, don't ever do that again.
Mm-hmm.
So they would change their tactics. Pretty much after every firefight.
Right. Okay. And were you all? Was it always the VC or the NVA, or do you know?
When we got hit really hard, mm-hmm. it was the NVA.
Mm-hmm.
The VC were pretty. They'd have one or two big weapons, and that would be it. I firmly believe if they had had the same weapons we had, they would have blown us out of the water. We couldn't have stood up to them.
Mm-hmm.
We would have had to change our tactics dramatically. We would have had to have close air support at all times. But they were pretty good, and we could take them. No battle that we were ever in did we ever back out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the 43 boat, you know, we lost the boat and everything else, but we didn't leave. You know, they left the battlefield. We never were run out of any place we ever were.
Mm-hmm.
But the Sonnendoch River that I mentioned earlier,
right.
There was supposedly an NVA battalion there, or mm-hmm. not a battalion, whatever company. And I'm not familiar with Army terms, but a group of a couple hundred.
Right.
Whatever that is. And they were pretty tough. And when we ran into them, we always got casualties.
Mm-hmm.
I think we always got more of them than we did them. Now, we had a humongous body count for the operations that we were on, but that was horribly inflated. Because when the 43 boat was blown up, we found a couple of helmets that had holes through them and blood all on the inside of them.
Mm, right.
And two or three indications that we probably, I would have said quite easily, we killed three or four people in that mm-hmm. engagement.
Mm-hmm.
Well, by the time it got back, it was 30 or 40. Because they said, well, here's a blood trail, and here's another one. And, then it got inflated, and it got inflated. Hell, it might have been 100 by the time it was all over.
Right, right.
And I saw the write-up of several of these operations I was on in Stars and Stripes.
Mm-hmm.
And they always had this super high body count. And it never was that. I mean, you know, if you did it properly, it'd probably been a tenth what was reported.
Right. Okay. All right. And what types of weapons were the enemy generally using?
They had claymore mines. A lot mm-hmm. of stuff stolen from us mm-hmm. or captured from us. We had I'll tell you a story about how we fix them. A lot of times the Vietnamese rough puffs or mm-hmm. National Guard.
Right.
Would lose their weapons,
mm-hmm.
and then but they would find a pile of money.
Right.
And, come home, and that happened. And then when we found out that happened, there were several of us that got a lot of ammunition, and we pulled all the bullets out of the cases, dumped out all of the powder,
mm-hmm.
and filled them with C4 explosives,
uh-huh.
and put them back together, and reloaded all the weapons and gave it to the rough puffs.
Right.
And they went out and lost those weapons and got a pile of money.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess when two or three of them blew up and killed some people, we heard all this through the CIA, but we spent one night filling these things with C4.
Right.
And evidently the rough puffs went back to take some more weapons, and they were all killed. So let's mm-hmm. stop that. But the weapons they had, we captured a this is no kidding, we captured a World War I German Mauser.
Wow.
Lots of AK-47s.
Mm-hmm.
A World War II grease gun.
Mm-hmm.
B-40 rockets.
Right.
We captured a lot of B-40 rockets, which are Russian. A lot of Claymore mines that were captured from the U.S. Mm-hmm. were turned around and used on us.
Right.
C-4, then they had M-16s. I mean, anything we had, they had.
Mm-hmm.
Just traded weapons, basically, up and down the rivers, depending on who was capturing who.
Right.
And they had, they did two things. They were getting these Russian weapons, which were 82-millimeter mortars, so that they could shoot their ammunition, and they could shoot ours, but we could never shoot their ammunition, because mm-hmm. we had 81-millimeter mortars. They also had a 51-caliber machine gun, so they could shoot their rounds and our rounds, but we couldn't shoot their rounds. Not that we want to, but that was their strategy, was that they could shoot any round on the battlefield, and we couldn't if anybody ran out of ammunition. And they had... I can't think of any handguns they carried. Maybe they did, but we never captured any.
Right. Okay. What weapon was the biggest threat to the swift boats?
Probably the B-40 rocket. Mm-hmm. They finally figured out how to do it. They were firing into the cabin area, which we didn't have anybody in the cabin area.
Mm-hmm.
I guess they thought that was where the powder was, and basically it blew out refrigerators or beds or something.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't harm anybody.
Right.
But then they started skipping them across the water. They'd fire it so it hit between them and the water, bounce up, and hit the back rails of the fantail, and it'd usually kill the two guys on the fantail.
Mm-hmm.
And we lost a lot of people from that. What I was always worried about were machine guns, but they didn't have a lot of those.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been just devastating to us. And one of the tricks they used, these rivers had big turns and curves in them. Just, you know, you'd go around, you'd be going around a curve, and you'd look back, and you'd see another swift boat coming. I mean, you'd see that across this thin piece of land, you'd see the other swift boat on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
What they'd do is they'd set up an ambush in the middle of that. When those two swift boats were on either side, one of them would just stand up and just shoot like crazy at one of them, duck down a spider hole, and if you weren't watching, you'd just spray the other boat with automatic weapons.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to be very careful about that.
Right, right. Okay. Were the swift boats built pretty well to where they could withstand the damage, or?
Oh no, they're quarter-inch aluminum.
Mm-hmm.
I laughed at one guy. He said, "Well, I was on a starting in World War II. I was on a boat that was just made out of plywood." I said, "That quarter-inch aluminum won't stop anything. Just go right through it."
Right.
Yeah, we'd come. It'd be. I can't tell you how many times I got down out of my gun tub, and I was on four different boats down there: the 93, the 10, the 56, and the 25.
Okay.
And I'd get out, and you'd just walk down the gun tub where I was in, and there'd just be bullet holes, just one or two of them, just on either side of me.
Mm-hmm.
And I caught one bullet in the back, and the only reason I knew that was that behind me was a big, huge, 100-pound slab of lead, so that when I kicked my hips one way or the other, the guns would move.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big weight. And that thing caught more bullets. You just look back there and you see holes in it. And of course, it was probably a 3 to 4 inch thick piece of lead.
Mm.
And of course, they wouldn't go through. But man, I'd feel like somebody just hit me in the back with a hammer.
Right.
And I had that happen to. Two times I know that happened to me. Mm. It may have happened more than that, but two times I remember quite well.
Mm.
But they didn't stop anything. They didn't stop. Matter of fact, sometimes the rockets would go through and explode on the other side as they were going out.
Right. Okay. They also, the VC also use a lot of, you mentioned mines in the river earlier. Was that a common occurrence?
That, when they could get them. Now, see, this is the thing. This is a hard area to get stuff into, and we were just locking things down as quick as we, General Yap even talked to Bill Frankie one time. He said, "You really caused us a lot of problems down there in the rivers." He said, We thought we were losing the war down there until you guys pulled out.
Mm-hmm.
And but they would, if they could get it in there, they'd put a mine in the river every chance they get.
Right.
But it wasn't as common. The most common attacks we got were rocket attacks.
Okay.
Rocket and small arms fire.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, based on what you just said, was your operations down there fairly successful then?
They were very successful, like I said, and we never lost a battle we were in.
Mm-hmm.
We always punished them more than they punished us, and we had control of the rivers. And like I said, this was a General Yap. He said he felt like we pretty well lost the rivers until we turned over all our boats to the Vietnamese.
Right.
And that's when he was able to come back down there and take over.
Okay. Speaking of the South Vietnamese, could you tell me a little bit about your take on them? I know you mentioned the Rough Puffs, but what about the South Vietnamese regular forces? Did you have much?
I didn't work with South Vietnamese regular forces,
okay.
Army. Now, Navy we did, because this was, we worked with Cambodian mercenaries, and they were really good.
Mm-hmm.
These were special forces trained Cambodian mercenaries.
Okay.
And Marines, and they were always ready to go fight.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the people we worked with. They were very tough. They went after everything they could. And the Navy, the Vietnamese Navy we worked with, this is what I was never understood. I went in there. They talked about all this. Nixon talked about all this Vietnamization. We're going to be out of Vietnam in 6 months. And I was thinking, well, shit, you know, they're going to have people in here. Then we got down there and said, well, you're going to be training Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the first trainee we got was Bao. And Bao was a gunner's mate, so I had to train Bao. And Bao, basically, every time that we got fired upon, you had to pry him up off the deck.
Mm, right.
They wouldn't stand and fight too rough. Now, there were some of them that were quite heroic,
mm-hmm.
but for the most part, they were not real intent on doing this. Of course, we were told, well, this is, you know, they have to go through this every day. This is their country. And I was saying, well, then by God, they ought to be really be interested in it more than we do.
Right.
Because we're going home.
Right.
As a matter of fact, when I got transferred out of Antoy and got transferred up to Quy Nhon and then later on Cameron, I became the leading petty officer of the boat and trained Vietnamese and brand new officers up there. And for the most part, I would have to say that it was less than successful.
Okay. All right. And can you tell me a little bit more about these Cambodian mercenaries? How did they operate?
Well, they operated, they were brought in, they had a special forces lieutenant
mm-hmm.
and usually a sergeant, some senior enlisted man sergeant. And they were a group of about, I want to say 30 to 50. I don't remember the exact number. I don't think it's 50. I think it's 30 to 40. And what we do is load them up on our boats. I got some really good pictures of them coming on board through just mud, trying to climb on the boats. But little bitty guys, full packs, gear, weapons, and they would take them out, and we'd drop them off. And then if they were sweeping a riverbank, we would go along with them to provide gunfire support.
Mm-hmm.
If they were going really deep, we just keep contact with a map, and we could drop mortar rounds in for them if they weren't too far away.
Right.
And they would operate anywhere from that day to maybe 2 or 3 days out searching areas.
Okay.
And then they'd come back in and get back on the boats.
Okay. All right. Let's see. Now, you mentioned in the your veterans questionnaire that one of the other things you did was that sometimes you would transport MedCat people into remote areas. Could you tell me about that?
Yeah, this was up. We did a little bit of that down south, not a lot.
Okay.
But we would take doctors and nurses into areas to have them check people out. But the one I remember is we went up. North of Tui Hoa Air Force Base. That would have been out of Quy Nhon. Out of Quy Nhon, we took a bunch of nurses and doctors and dropped them off, and they went back into a village and did a lot of MedCap where they'd even pick up kids that had cleft palates,
uh-huh.
and we'd take them back and they'd put them in the hospital and do plastic surgery on them. But they basically do medical treatment to villagers.
Uh-huh.
And then down at Sun Cao Harbor, there was this huge harbor just south of there, south of Quy Nhon and Trang, and it has a ship in it that was sunk during World War II, a Japanese freighter that was bringing troops in that rumor had it Ho Chi Minh and his people sunk it, but I don't even know if Ho Chi Minh was there at the time, but that was the rumor.
Mm-hmm.
But when the Japanese were invading, they blew this up. But we would take doctors down there, drop them off at these villages across the bay, and then we'd come back and build a big fire, and then we'd go pick them back up when they were done, and we'd have a big picnic out there on the top deck of the ship, which is about 3 inches above the waterline. But it was still there, and you could still walk around on top of it. And we'd build a big fire and cook steaks on it. But that was during the MedCap part of it.
Okay.
But we'd basically, our job was to get the doctors up to these villages that they couldn't get to any other way.
Right. Okay. All right. And I'm kind of jumping around here a little bit. Sorry. But a little earlier, you were talking about John Kerry and his boat. Did you ever have any interaction with him?
All the time.
Okay. What would you mind telling me a little bit about him? Or?
Sure. He was in Antoy, where the combat was, for 6 weeks. I was there for almost 8 months.
Mm-hmm.
He was an arrogant son of a bitch, mm-hmm. but he very condescending. But he was around. Even at that time, he was telling everybody he was going to be president of the United States.
Right.
But I was on two incidents with him. That one was the March the 19th incident, where the three boat was blown up.
Right.
And he supposedly got... I'll go back. He went into the village, and he threw this hand grenade into a bag of rice. This is before we got there, and it blew up and blew some rice into his butt. So when we were coming out, the three boat was blown up, and that's when he went off, and he fired all over the rivers and everything and shot up everything that they could. When we were hit, he would leave the kill zone. What you're supposed to do is stay there and make sure every boat gets out of the kill zone before you leave it.
Right.
But he was just firing like a maniac. But anyway, after this incident, we're going out of the river, and the three boat blows up, and we're over there picking people up out of the water. We picked two guys up out of the water ourselves that were blown out of the water. And then we start over. We're going to pick up this other guy that fell off Kerry's boat when he took off. And it was Rassman, the guy that, I don't know if you ever saw the stuff he was on there, Special Forces guy. Kerry supposedly saved his life.
Right.
We were within 10 foot of picking him up, and Kerry's boat zoomed in and picked him up. And then Kerry transfers over to our boat because we're going out to the after we got the boat, we're ready to go out. Kerry transfers over to our boat because we're going out to the Coast Guard cutter, and he wants to be dropped off for medical treatment. Well, once we get out in the ocean, I hop out of the gun tub, clean up my stuff, walk around the wreck there on the fantail, and we're carrying the rough puff that was killed. One of the rough puffs stepped on a mine and was shredded, and we had him wrapped up. He was on the fantail. Kerry was on the fantail, and two other guys, I think, were wounded in something else. We're on the fantail. We were taken back to get medical treatment, too, that were blown off the other boat. And he's got this thing. I said, what happened to you? He says, the mine blew up next to us. And I go, there was another mine? He says, yeah. Well, nobody else saw it, but supposedly this mine blew up and threw shrapnel into him. Well, the only problem with that is that these were underwater mines, and you can't get shrapnel from an underwater mine. It doesn't go through the water.
Right.
You get concussion problems, but you don't get shrapnel.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we took him out there. There was no blood or anything, and dropped him off. And the next thing, he sends a report in saying that we went through 5 kilometers of heavy automatic weapons. Well, I can tell you this. If our six boats had been through 5 kilometers of heavy weapons fire, we'd all been dead. We couldn't stood up to it because there was no protection.
Right.
And we were out there in the middle of it. But yeah, he was quite a piece of work. He would film. He would go back in. We'd go back in the rivers, and he'd refilm things that happened just for his own stuff.
Hmm. Right.
If you ever want to read Unfit for Command, it'll give you a whole thing. I'm in there several times too.
Okay.
But Unfit for Command by John O'Neill.
Okay.
It's a fairly short read, but it'll tell you everything that happened to him and what he pulled. The funny thing about it, when we went up to Washington D.C. to talk about this, I said, I'll tell my story, but I'm telling my story. I'm not changing it for you guys.
Right.
I said, oh, that's fine. That's fine. So we were, and everybody around the room says, yeah, I mean, you know, we may be wrong on it. So we started telling the story, and everybody had the same story, what happened on each one of these incidents. And there were about 30 of us that had been with Kerry when all this stuff happened. And one of the things I got dressed down for when I was on TV on Fox News with couple of people, they said, well, you weren't on Kerry's boat. And I said, no, but I was there in the river with him. Yeah, but you weren't on his boat. And I said, no, but I said, that's like saying that the soldiers weren't on Custer's mule whenever he was fighting the Sioux and Cheyenne. I said I was right there, right beside him, but
right.
We weren't on the boat. But no, I was on just about every mission Kerry was on,
mm-hmm.
except for when he got a Silver Star. I wasn't on that mission.
Right.
But on his two Purple Hearts and his Bronze Star, I was there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And when he got back to the States and was engaging in the war protests, and what was your thoughts about that?
I pulled out of Vietnam in 1970, mm-hmm. January 1970, and about 4 days later, I was on a college campus enrolled.
Uh-huh.
And I had, at that time, things had gotten nasty. We were called baby killers and all sorts of other stuff. And I didn't tell anybody I was even in the service. I'm here in school. I didn't tell anybody I was in the Navy.
Right.
But, now when he came on, I called this good friend of mine, and I said, can you believe that son of a bitch? I said, and that's when he got up and started telling that we were committing all these atrocities and we were doing all this other stuff. And I tell you, we had no fire zones. We couldn't shoot. We had rules of engagement all the way through. There were certain places you could shoot, certain places you couldn't shoot,
mm-hmm.
Places you could shoot only if you were shot at.
Right.
And there were times we were taking fire that there were villagers in between us and we didn't shoot. I mean, we just didn't commit these atrocities. You know, according to him, we were out there raping, pillaging, killing babies, doing all, and it just didn't happen.
Right.
You've never seen a more, I hate to use the word honorable, but a group of people that did what, I was in an all-volunteer group. We all had to volunteer to be in the Navy.
Right.
We all had, as a matter of fact, because I was from Stillwater, I didn't even have to worry about it. There were so many people that flunked out of Oklahoma State University and would go down and sign up that nobody from Payne County was ever inducted. Never was drafted because they always had their quota.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew this because I knew the court. I didn't, you know, none of us had to be there. We were all volunteers. We didn't, the drug use didn't happen
right.
in our group at all. Now, well, I say that. You've got to count alcohol as a drug. Yeah, there was heavy drug use for that.
But, mm-hmm.
you know, the marijuana and everything else, it didn't happen in our group.
Right.
And we were trying to do the right thing all the way through. And it was a very, I hate to use the word, honorable is the wrong word because that brings on Knights of the Round Table type stuff, but we were just very professional about what we were doing,
mm-hmm.
All the way through.
Right.
And this stuff of being smeared that we were murderers and killers and committed all these war crimes is just bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I decided if there was ever anything I could do to bring that guy down, I was going to do it. Well, I knew that there wasn't any way that was going to happen. You know, I'm some smuck from the middle of America. And he's a powerful East Coast guy. There's no way in hell I could do it. But when it came around and there was a chance to tell the true story, I was really happy to do it.
Sure, sure. All right. Did he ever voice his opinions about the war and his views there while he was in Vietnam around
no,
you guys?
Not to, well, let me say this. To me, he didn't.
Mm.
He voiced his views that he was going to be president of the United States. I heard him say that several times. He, but as far as the war was right and the war was wrong, no, he never said a word one.
Okay.
To me.
Right. All right. Okay. Well, let's see. I guess we'll, aside from John Kerry, and back to your own experiences, when you were not on a mission, when you were not on operation, how would you spend your free time?
Oh, well, there weren't many ways down there. Of course, there's, I was in three different divisions, and we're just talking about Antoy right now.
Right.
I read or drank. That was pretty much it. There wasn't anything else to do. When you say free time, now, when we were off, there wasn't a lot of free time. You came back, you might come off a 24-hour mission. You spent 8 or so hours cleaning and the boat, fixing the boat up. If the boat was in really bad shape, you went to dry dock, and then you painted and cleaned the boat in there. and then you'd sleep and eat, and then it was about time to go out on patrol again.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there just wasn't any free time at all. When I did have any free time, like if we were in transit, it might take, you know, 5 or 6 hours to get from one river to the next. I'd go grab a rack someplace and pull out books and read.
Mm-hmm.
I read a ton of books while I was over there.
Okay.
And, then if we could ever get in any place you could buy a beer, we'd go have beer.
right.
And that was a rarity. Now, one of the things they used to do when we were up on the Apple was you can't have beer on board ship. So they'd pull this barge around, just this big flat barge.
Mm-hmm.
And on Saturday nights, they'd give everybody two San Miguel beers from the Philippines. And so you'd get out on this barge, and there'd be 30 of us out on this barge, just shoulder to shoulder.
Right.
And everybody would get two beers. And you'd get your friends that didn't drink to come down there and get their beers, and you'd take theirs.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd start drinking beer. Well, here we are. We're in the middle of the ocean. The waves are moving this barge up and down. It's rocking back and forth, and everybody's just getting plastered ass drunk. And but nobody ever fell overboard the whole time.
Right.
we got to do that. Not very often, but every once in a while they'd do that for us.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was an enlisted men's club in the village in town, but there wasn't anything we could go in and do there.
Okay. All right. Did you ever get a chance to go on R&R?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Where did you go?
I went to Hawaii and met my wife.
Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, we just got flew in there and spent 5 days in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
In Oahu there.
Right. How did it feel being away from the war?
Oh, it was wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was absolutely wonderful. One of the things I was talking about, of course, that I went back. I went to R&R and got back, and I was in a fairly safe area.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't go to R&R until I got out of Antoy.
Okay.
So by that time, I had transferred up to Quinion, which we had one big, massive, one-sided firefight up there, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
So when I flew, yeah, it was just nice being out of there, but then I flew back. I mean, I was by that time, we were doing ocean patrols.
Uh-huh.
So the, we'd search a couple of junks, go over and find an island, anchor off, cook some steaks, watch the sunset, maybe get on the mask and snorkel around through the lagoon there. And, we had a spear gun, and we'd spear some fish and cook some fish. But it was a very safe place to be.
Mm-hmm.
In Vietnam, it was a safe place to be. Like I said, we had one big firefight, and that was it. The couple of months that I was there.
Okay. All right.
But yeah, coming, it was wonderful to get out of there, and I sure hated going back.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah.
Okay.
But it was a great break.
Right. All right. And you said that you served with three different divisions there. Did you volunteer to come back twice?
Oh, no. It was all within the year I was there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was all within the... Like I said, you're supposed to only spend 3 months in the combat zone down in Antoy, and then you just got to go someplace safe the rest of the time there, supposedly.
Right.
When I say safe, it's relatively safe. There weren't they weren't hosing you off the causeway at the end of each day.
Okay.
In these places. It was dangerous, but it wasn't... it wasn't anywhere near as dangerous as the ground pounders are being down in Antoy.
Mm-hmm.
We were searching... You know, there's all sorts of things that could happen to you. But one time when I was training Vietnamese up, and we were trying to train them, I told the boat officer, I said, I'm going to go jump off the fantail and see if they'll do a man overboard drill. And I went walking through the cabin, just happened, wasn't going to, but just happened to grab a life jacket.
Mm-hmm.
And just went over. Everybody was at general quarters, so these guys were manning their guns. And I just jumped off the fantail.
Mm-hmm.
And I turned around and looked. Of course, the ocean was kind of rough. There was some fairly good swells going. And I turned around and looked, and these guys were just staring at me. It was like, you know, wonder what he's doing. And so, I was hoping. All of a sudden, the boat just disappeared, and I was out in the middle ocean by myself.
Huh.
About 2 minutes later, it seemed like 2 hours, the boat turned around and came back and picked me up.
Right.
But, they didn't do anything. But that's... You can do something like that and lose your life, too.
Sure.
But as far as getting shot at and stuff like that, it just didn't happen that much.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
In those areas. But, yes, no, I got back. I really didn't want to go back. I was ready. It was September, and I had 4 or 5 months to go, which seemed at that time in my life like an eternity.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, you just got back. And usually the things like it was always harder to go back in and get on the boats when you've had some time off.
Right.
We were talking about that this weekend. We were talking about when you were the most scared. And I said, you know, as long as we were in the river, even during firefights, I was never scared. I was just, I knew everything that was going on. I was calm, collected. I said, when I was scared was right before you went into the river, or if you'd had 2 or 3 days off, because it was just day after day after day, and you were out there getting shot at, and patrolling, and checking stuff out. It just didn't seem to matter.
Mm-hmm.
But when you got a day or two off, even in country, and you had a couple beers, and you relaxed, you read a book, going back in was just absolute hell.
Mm-hmm.
That's when it bothered me the most.
Okay. All right. And so you were, let me see if I can get this right, you were at Antoy for how many months?
I was at Antoy from January till 1st of September.
Okay.
Is that right? No, 1st of August.
All right.
And then I was in Quinyon till sometime in October. And in October I transferred to Cameron Bay and spent my last couple of months at Cameron Bay.
Okay. Could you tell me a little bit more about your duties at Quinyon?
Sure. Quinyon is a little city, a little bay, and we had, on one side, we had the naval base over there, and then this big, huge mountain that went up behind us. And then on the other side, the mountain went down into the sea.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other side was this giant army base. What we would do there, and it was, this was, we were not stationed on board a ship or an Apple or a any type of naval vessel. This was an actual land-based operation. We had causeways, and we had all the way down. We had then the officers' quarters, then the main office, and then the officers' club, and then at the far end, next to the fence, was enlisted quarters, and then on the other side was a small village, which had prostitutes and bars and all sorts of other stuff, which they would open up at 3 o'clock every day for people to go into if they wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
The operations, and then across the way was the army base, and our job was to patrol the bay along with the Coast Guard. They had some Coast Guard WHECs in there.
Mm-hmm.
Not WHECs, WPBs in there.
Okay.
And then we had and then our job, we had sectors of the coast, and we would go out usually about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, relieve the other boat, go out and patrol our sector up and down for 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And any boats that came into view that looked suspicious, we would pull over and board and search. Anybody that called for gunfire support, we would pull over and fire our mortar to provide for them. That was a rarity. But if there was any troops in there that got in trouble, we could provide gunfire support in for, you know, a mile or so.
Right.
And then you do a 24-hour patrol, then you have 24 off.
Okay.
And 24 off, you usually worked on the boat. Usually on weekends, you could go into the city or go over to the army clubs over on the other side. There wasn't really a hell of a lot to see in the city.
Mm-hmm.
We usually just go over to the EM Club and drink beer in the afternoon and play pool.
Right.
And it was a rather tropical-type setting.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice, very pretty area. And did a lot of interesting stuff there. That's where we did that MedCap. That's where that boat was, that ship that was sunk, the Japanese ship was in the harbor, Sunkow Harbor, that we used to tie up to.
Right.
Do our patrols off there.
Mm-hmm.
Went through one hell of a typhoon there in a boat for 24 hours. Just beat us to death.
Mm-hmm.
We had waves that were as high as the boat. Just come crashing down on top of us one right after another. And went through that for 24 hours till we finally got to a harbor. Until we went, I think it's 10 miles in 24 hours.
Wow.
It was just absolutely horrendous. But that was, I was in two typhoons, and that was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
The other one was down south.
Okay.
And we did med caps there. We checked out boats. That's where we got to the firefight that really pretty much ruined my hearing. In the middle of the night, we all had these Browning automatic weapons in our bunks next to our beds to fight our way back down to the boat since we weren't close to them. and if anything happened, and all of a sudden somebody started shooting up on the hillside, and they said we had VC coming in the gate, coming down the fence line. So it was our job to get to the boats and get the boats away. It wasn't to protect the base. That was the other guy's job, to protect the base. So we grabbed these BARs and ran to the boats, got our boats out, and then we started providing support fire for them. We just pulled off a little ways. And as a matter of fact, this was, I forgot what it was, what day it was, but they thought we were having a fireworks display. The Army did. They didn't even know we were on general quarters, that we were under attack. So we started firing our illumination rounds. And we fired, just off our boat itself, we fired 100 rounds of 81-millimeter illumination rounds and high explosives,
right,
all without ear protection. And that's why I still have trouble hearing today.
Okay.
But we did that all night long, and they never found a body or anything up there, so we're not sure if the guy just woke up and started firing his gun, said VC are coming, or if there actually were VC coming. But we fired thousands and thousands of dollars worth of ammunition off 8 or 9 boats that night.
Right. All right. Were there any other particularly memorable moments there at Quinyon?
Oh, yeah, that was where we stole. There's three of my buddies, and I've got a picture of it. But we went over to the Army base to drink one night, and we got through drinking. It was about midnight. We had to get back, and what you did is there was this mic boat where you could, you'd walk on, you know, it's the one where the Marines run off in the movies. But
right.
The front flops down, you walk on, they pull it up, they drive you back over the Army base. And this thing runs every hour on the hour, running people back and forth between the Naval base and the Army base. And so we went over to the Army base, and it's midnight. They said, no, we can't let you out after midnight. I said, well, we got to be back at the base. We're leaving on patrol tomorrow morning.
Right.
No, you can't leave here unless you're in a truck, you can't leave on foot. Going to do. So we start walking back, and all of a sudden, here's the motor pool. So we went over there and found a deuce and a half that had its keys in it. We hopped in it, and drove out of the main gate of the Army base, drove on over, drove it on the mic boat, drove it over to our base, and we kept it for about, I think we got to keep that for about a month. Anyway, we painted a peace sign on the side of it, and 95 Charlie, which was our boat number.
Right.
And we were the only enlisted men that I knew that had our own boat that we went back and forth the boat. Finally, the officers came down and questioned us about it and said, oh, no, we just had this. Where'd you get it? Well, we don't know. Just behind our barracks. So they took it away from us and found out it was the Army's and gave it back to the Army. But we had that for, I think it's about a month we had that. Oh, we had a lot of fun there. There was a lot of neat things to do. And like I said, being out of the pressure cooker and getting out of Antoy was just absolutely wonderful.
Right. When you would go into, you mentioned going into the cities and stuff occasionally, would you have much interaction with the South Vietnamese, and what was your opinion of just the civilians?
Well, let's see, I got my pockets picked. That's the only time I've traveled all over the world since then, and I've never had my pockets picked, but I got them picked there.
Uh-huh.
Not a lot of interaction, no.
Uh-huh.
You know, somewhat. But yeah, it was, I mean, they were nice people.
Uh-huh.
They were trying to get your money every way they could.
Sure.
And I can't blame them because they were poor in a war-torn country.
Right.
There were places. That's where I was shopping. I was trying to change some MPC into dong and use the dong to go buy stuff. And when I changed it, these kids ran up to me and ran into me. And the next thing I knew, all my money was gone.
Mm-hmm.
And my watch, too. They got my money and my watch in just about 2 seconds.
Goodness.
I'd go out to restaurants, and which the rest of the guys didn't do. And I'd usually be sitting there with a bunch of officers, which they weren't too excited about. But
right.
I got into a couple of really nice restaurants and had some Vietnamese meals.
Mm.
And you'd go hit the the shops. And, I bought a bunch of silk and brought back for Sheila. Just kind of walk around. There wasn't a hell of a lot to do.
Right.
In those towns like that. We didn't have a whole lot of interaction with them. Most of the interaction I had with South Vietnamese were the ones that were in the military.
Okay. All right. What did you think of the Vietnamese food?
Oh, I hated it. I didn't eat rice for about 10 years. Yeah, it was crazy. See, we had to, when I was training them, we ate Vietnamese food.
Mm.
And I just got sick of it. You know, we you'd have eyeball stew, right. All sorts of crap, fish head soup,
right,
and rice for morning, rice for breakfast. And then they started. Then they decided. Then we also had, when we got back to the apple, we could have American chow, and you know, we'd have shrimp and lobster and steak and all this other stuff. The Navy took good care of us as far as food went, but then they decided they were going to try to be more thoughtful towards the Vietnamese, so we started having all sorts of, and it's just crap. Just rice for breakfast, rice for lunch, rice for dinner.
Right.
Yeah, I couldn't eat it after I got home.
Uh-huh. All right. Is there anything else you'd like to say about your experience at Quy Nhon before we move on to Cameron Bay?
Oh, let's see. No, I think that pretty much covers Quy Nhon.
Okay. All right. Can you tell me a little bit about Cameron Bay now then?
Yeah, Cameron was a very nice base. That's where, you know, you see all these things where Bob Hope and all those people come to. That's where he'd go. I mean, when you're out in the boondocks, they don't come to see you.
Right.
But we had a couple of entertainers come over at Cameron Bay. We never went to see them because you had to go over to the Army base. But we had a very nice enlisted men's club, a very big, nice enlisted men's club. They had the boats, but we were we were the only two that still left on the boats. Everybody else had been transferred off or either to staff jobs or sent back home out of our original boat crew. So the two of us were still serving on boats up to the last dying minute. And I was the leading petty officer. Renshaw and I both made second class, which was, nobody could figure out how that happened. I said, we just have to study and pass the damn test. I was the youngest enlisted man in Vietnam in the Navy. I was the youngest enlisted man in Vietnam. And there was an E-5, youngest E-5 petty officer in Vietnam. But they were sending all these brand-new officers in, and they'd give them to us, and we'd go out and do some training with them and show them how to run the boat, do all this other stuff, and they'd ship them off back down to Antoy.
Mm-hmm.
And we were doing that. And we had to be, without a doubt, the senior enlisted people on boats.
Mm-hmm.
We had more time, more rank, and everything else. And we were just so we'd go out on these patrols, and I just hated it because this is when it really got crappy, because you're having to go out on these idiotic patrols that didn't mean anything. And we'd go out and we'd search a boat. And this is another time we got caught in some really rough weather. I told the officer, I said, we just need to return to base. We don't need to be out here. But he was scared to death. He was an ensign, brand new. I mean, he had been in the Navy weeks, and he was scared to death. So we spent 24 hours out in this storm, just being beat to death. And so we go in to be relieved, and we're going in, and the other boat's coming out to relieve us out of the harbor. And it says, this is, I think it was Rice Twigs Bravo. This is Rice Twigs Bravo 93. Returning to base, weather too rough. So they turn around, they beat us back to the harbor, and they were our relief boat.
Right.
But they were smart enough not to be out in that rough weather.
Right.
So, anyway, we trained three or four Vietnamese. We have three or four Vietnamese on our crew and one or two officers.
Mm-hmm.
And one officer. And we would go out and we'd train them a while, and then they'd take them down south.
Right.
And this kept happening and kept happening and kept happening. And finally they got down. This was January 2nd of 70. And we still hadn't got our orders out. We should have been real soon. And they said, we're having a big push down at Antoy. We're taking every boat and all divisions. We're going to Antoy and we're going up the rivers. And I said, no, I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
They said, oh, yes, you are. I said, no, I'm not going. I'm not going down there. And Renshaw said, no, I'm not going either. I'm going. So they said, we'll see about that. So they came back a few. Well, okay, you don't have to go, but you're going to stay here and you're going to be assigned to the causeway duty, which is down there where all the boats are.
Mm-hmm.
And so we go down there the next morning, and there's some third class petty officer, and he says, okay, you guys get some brooms and sweep off the causeway. I said, I'm going to be up at the enlisted men's club if you need me until I get my orders out of here. And so basically, we spent the last, I think, 7 days in country at the enlisted men's club. I'm not going.
Right.
I'm not doing anything. I'm not cleaning the causeway.
Sure.
And so about the next day, they said, okay, you've got your orders out. And so we had our plane tickets and everything else, and we were headed back. But I had all my uniform stolen.
Mm-hmm.
So all I had was dungarees and some jungle greens, mm-hmm. and they wouldn't let you go back in country with that. But I had had a tailor-made suit, three-piece suit made mm-hmm. while I was there. So I said, well, how can you go out in a suit? I said, yeah, you can go out in a suit. So I showed up at the, they flew us out of Cameron, so I showed up at the Air Force base in a three-piece suit, and they thought I was CIA. So I got up in the front of the plane.
Right.
And it was quite a nice trip back until then I got, of course, the bad thing is I got, when I got back, they were mustering us out of the Navy, and we were at the Naval base there in Seattle. And they told us, as I'm going to tell you a story that I told you, I'm going to tell you something, a story way back at the front when we started talking.
Okay.
And they said, oh, you got to have a dress blue uniform. I said, well, I don't have a dress blue uniform. You can't get out of the Navy without one. Shit. So I had to go buy a complete brand new uniform to get out of the Navy.
Right
before I got. But anyway, I was going to tell you a story I told you earlier about, you know, Jackson and Pike Street where we went down to.
Right.
When I was there a couple of years earlier. And so they came in, they said, all right, you guys can have liberty for 2 days, and we're going to muster you out of the Navy. And but whatever you do, don't go down to Jackson and Pike Street. We've had 140 sailors stabbed down there this year.
Wow.
And or last year, rather. We had 140-some sailors stabbed, robbed, beaten down at Jackson Pike Street. Don't go down there.
Right.
He said, all right. So we start going out there. Renshaw's a little rough around the edges and stuff. He wasn't too worried about stuff. And he said, well, you know Seattle. Where are we going? I said, Jackson and Pike Street. That's where all the fun is, man.
Right. So
we went down there. Of course, I still wasn't 21. Uh-huh. But I started drinking, and we drank a bunch. And Shore Patrol almost caught us. He was 21. I wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And but anyway, we got back to the base and got mustered out. But that was the story I was telling you about the Jackson Pike Street to get it all back right.
Right, right.
But, yeah, we flew out of Cameron, and, gosh, within 4 days, I went from being in the jungle to being a campus at Oklahoma State University.
Mm-hmm.
So,
was the adjustment fairly difficult or not?
No, it really wasn't. It was just different,
mm-hmm.
you know. But I had a good support system. I mean, all my family was there.
Right.
Like I said, I told my father-in-law I wanted to be on campus, and I was enrolled.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there wasn't any problem with that.
Right.
So, got back, and my wife was there, and we, you know, just started back in our life again.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I don't have any difficulty with these guys that are coming back right now. I don't know if you...
Right.
We had a bunch of money left over after we fought John Kerry.
Mm-hmm.
We had a couple $1 million left over in our funds.
Right.
And we've been giving that out to wounded veterans coming back from Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And we've given out almost... We got $2 million from Boone Pickens lately.
Right.
But we've given out almost $4 million to these guys. And I go over to BAMSI over at San Antonio.
Mm-hmm.
The hospital over there,
right?
And talk to these young men coming back, and they're just having a hell of a time. Of course,
uh-huh.
they're wounded horribly. Now, that's one thing about it. I was never wounded.
Right.
I went through a lot of crap,
mm-hmm.
and I went through a lot of scary stuff and saw a lot of really bad stuff, but I get real upset with my colleagues who were with me that are now getting money for PTSD
mm-hmm.
and other kinds of shit like that. I just have a real problem with that.
Right.
I think if we had been in a prisoner of war camp and had been beaten and everything, we might have PTSD, but I don't think what we went through would have brought that about.
Okay.
It was bad. It was bad, a lot of stuff, but you just have to, you need to, when bad things happen, you just move on with your life.
Mm.
But as far as adjustment, I just can't say that I had any trouble adjusting at all.
Okay.
I went back to a... I was getting ready to go to college, you know, something I wanted to do. I had money. I had a new car. My wife and I were having a good time. Matter of fact, I've never had more expendable income my whole life, but we were both working, going to college. I had a job in a lab. She had a job in the library. I was getting GI Bill. We had a three-bedroom house on campus. I've never had more money in my life.
Mm-hmm.
than I had. I don't have that much money now. But the transition was minimal, I'd have to say.
Okay.
Yeah, the only thing, what I did was I just shut up. Now, even my family didn't ask about what happened. I mean, it was a real strange thing, because I remember my dad talking about World War II, but, you know, basically my family didn't ask me a thing about it. It was just like, oh, you just got home from a camping trip, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
Never asked me about anything that happened or anything. And it was by that time, Oklahoma State was not the hotbed of dissension.
Sure.
But there was still a lot of, you know, baby killer stuff and everything else going on. Just caused me to shut up. As a matter of fact, I still was in the Naval Reserve, so I had to go down and drill, and I just hid my uniform and would drive down and put it on when I got there.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't want anybody to know that I was in the military.
Right. Okay, and that brought up one of the questions I wanted to ask you about your, and you've kind of talked about this, but your reception. Did you ever have any problems with civilians and people giving you hell about being in the Navy?
Oh, yeah, comments and stuff, but basically those had come lately. There was, like I said, I had a supervisor at Conoco that I was working for, and I don't know if I told you this or not, but and I never told anybody even at Conoco that I'd been in the service, but somehow it came out, and she said, oh, you were in Vietnam?
Mm-hmm.
I said, yeah. She says, but you don't seem crazy.
Jeez.
Well, yeah, that's true.
Right.
But I tell you what, most of the people, and I mean everybody that I was friends with, had some tour of duty in Vietnam during that time period, came back. If they didn't go, let me tell you my boat crew story.
Okay.
My, you know, you hear about all these crazy-ass people that come back and just go to hell and drugs and all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. My quartermaster came back. Didn't go to college. He had about 2 years of college, but he went to work for the railroad, worked his way up to an engineer. Then he worked his way up in the union and was the chief negotiator for the railroad unions. He was doing such a good job that the railroad hired him away, and he became, and I told him he was the guy that took away all the orphans and widows' pensions. But he was some vice president of CSX Railroads when he retired. The radarman, he came back, went to college about 2 years, dropped out of college, went to work for the phone company as a splicer, worked his way up, retired last year as vice president of Southwestern Bell, whatever it is now. It's
wow.
Up in St. Louis. Did extremely well for himself. Our engineman went to college, got his degree, and was the IT director for several newspapers in Jacksonville, Florida. And I didn't do as well. I had to keep changing jobs, but I got my degree in forestry and worked as a forester and a professional Boy Scout for a while, and then got my degree in geology and was an international exploration geologist for quite a few years.
Okay.
And so every single one of us, I mean all of them that I have contact with, did well. And you don't hear the story. We don't have anybody that, you know, you hear this under a bridge with a bottle,
right,
type stories, which I sometimes wonder if those really are Vietnam veterans, but
right.
Some of them, I'm sure some of them are.
Mm-hmm.
But the reception, I guess, most of us just blocked it out and said, well, you know, if they're going to be that way, we'll just keep quiet and just, you know, ignored it.
Right.
But for the most thing, it was just the, there was no real nice homecoming. As a matter of fact, I didn't get a really good homecoming until just a couple of years ago, and for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And people welcoming you back from Vietnam. There's other Vietnam veterans who are doing it.
Right.
The pride of doing it didn't come until just a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Could you tell me a little bit about that homecoming?
Oh, sure. We were, we went up to, they found a swift boat. Oh, there's actually two homecomings that happened. We found a swift boat, and they redid it, and they put it in the Washington Naval Yard there, where the historic part of it is dedicated to the swift boat. And they had we had a meeting of all swift boat veterans, and there was about 200 of us that went up to Washington, D.C. And it was just really great. But Admiral Zumwalt, who had been chief of naval operations and chief of operations Vietnam,
right,
came forward, and he gave us a real pep talk about how good we had done and how proud he was of us. And that was the first time I ever felt great pride in what I'd done. From that point on, he got to meet a lot of people, and, you know, basically. But then when we all got together to do this John Kerry thing, and there were several hundred of us that got together, that in some way had served with him or around him and knew what he actually had done in Vietnam, which was different than his book, Tour of Duty.
Right.
And I don't know if you know the historian. He's now at the University of Houston. Gosh, name slips my mind. But he did John Kerry's History, Tour of Duty.
Okay.
And he's not a historian, but because he didn't even come and ask anybody else that was, you know, around him.
Right.
But anyway, we got together, and it was just like homecoming week. You know, hear all, you know, tell all the stories about what happened to you and everything else, and a bunch of people came in, and it was just really nice because you actually felt like, you know, what you did, there was somebody that actually appreciated it and said something to you. Because even back then, my own family didn't even recognize what I had done. It's just like, you know, you'd been gone for a while, now it's time to get back and get to college.
Right.
Forget that stuff, your camping trip's over.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the way it was back then. That wasn't just for me, that was for everybody.
Right.
So it wasn't anything out of the ordinary.
Okay. All right. Well, before we wrap this up, I have some broad questions about the war. But one other thing I actually want to ask you about. Would you mind telling me a little bit about the Swift Boat campaign and the campaign against Kerry and how it came about? And could you tell me a little bit about it?
Yeah, I'll tell you about my side of it.
Okay.
He started running for president, and this is when I knew. I told Sheila. And, of course, she met him in Coronado.
Mm-hmm.
She knew him.
Okay.
And she had seen him on TV, so she knew, and she knew my absolute hatred of him.
Right.
He was starting to run for president. I can't believe this shit. I said, there's nothing I can do about it. Nobody had listened to me. All that crap he says is just garbage.
Mm-hmm.
And I got this call, and it's from John O'Neill, the guy that wrote the book, Unfit for Command.
Right.
And he said, Van, he said, I just like, were you there on the March 19th incident when John Kerry got his Bronze Star? And I said, well, I think so. I said, I can't remember exactly which one. He says, well, go online and read. It's on his website. So I go on there and I read this thing about this magnificent firefight and him pulling people from the river and bullets going off for 5 kilometers and all this stuff. And I call him back. I said, no, John. I said, I wasn't on that incident at all. And he said, well, it's when the 3-boat blew up. I said, well, yeah, I was right. I said, I'll tell you how close I was to when the 3-boat blew up. I said, I was covered with water. I said, the water from the explosion just covered our boat.
Right.
We were not 25 foot behind him when it blew up.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, that's the incident. I said, well, none of that crap happened.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, would you mind telling that to a private investigator? I said, sure. So the private investigator called me and said, would you write up what happened? So I wrote up what happened, sent it to him.
Right.
And so they got all this together, and they held a press conference up in Washington, D.C., to refute what, you know, Kerry's story. Main thing was, my problem was that what he said when he came back to the Senate about how we were all murderers and killers and
sure.
We were doing horrible stuff. That's what just absolutely just irked me.
Right.
So held this press conference. I wasn't part of the press conference. They held a press conference, and nobody came. The news media didn't want to hear it. They did not want to hear anything bad about John Kerry.
Right.
So they called and says, well, would you mind coming to Washington, D.C. and telling your story on tape? I said, sure. So I get up there, and there's probably 30 of us in the room, and about 10 of us out of that group had actually served with John Kerry. And so they had us make that first advertisement. And that advertisement has been the most effective political ad ever in the United States history.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, the Smithsonian Institute asked for copies of it 2 weeks after it was out.
Wow.
To put the Smithsonian.
Right.
But anyway, we just started telling our story. Then they said, well, would you go on and do show? Of course, we didn't have any money. We had to come up with $50,000 for that thing. So we raised all money amongst us.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went out and started trying to raise money just on the Internet. And once that ad came out, the money just poured in. We raised $26 million during the campaign.
Right.
And spent it all except $2 million of it on the campaign. Making ads and doing different stuff, but they would. I shut my business down, lost money for about 6 months, and just went and gave interviews. They asked me to do that, and I said I'd be happy to, since I was one of the ones that was on there. But I gave probably 5 to 10 interviews a day, for day after day after day, and but the only people that would really listen to us first was talk radio and Fox News.
Mm-hmm.
Then when we started getting some traction, the main media would call us, and I got interviewed by the big guys at Newsweek. Of course, they basically didn't believe me the whole time we were talking. But it's basically just trying to tell a story.
Right.
But the neat thing came was when they called down and they said, hey, would you like to go to the Democratic Convention in Boston?
Mm-hmm.
I said, yeah. They said, well, here's the deal. There's going to be a pass for you. Just get up there and we'll call you. So I fly up there. Swift Boat Veterans paid for it. I didn't pay for it.
Uh-huh.
So I flew up there, got me a hotel room, and got a call, and they said, there's a TGI Fridays right next to the Fleet Center.
Mm-hmm.
Go there and look under a stack of papers. I said, all right. So I go there, and here's a badge to get into the Democratic Convention.
Mm-hmm.
And it wouldn't let me down on the floor, but it let me in Radio Row. So I put this thing on, and I go walking in. They don't stop me or anything.
Right.
And I go up to Radio, and I've got one interview. And I go up and I sit down and I start having this interview with this guy and start telling people. Now, I mean, the radio people all around him start looking and listening. And I gave I think it was 18 interviews I gave that day
mm-hmm.
at the Democratic Convention to NPR Radio, to NPR Radio in South America.
Wow.
And they finally realized what I was doing and they started following. They never did kick me out, but they started following me around
mm-hmm.
and watching what I was doing. But I went up to Sean Hannity and said, you know, I'd like to talk to you. And he said, no, we don't know anything about you. I said, okay, all right. That's before the ad came out. And then
right.
I went over and talked to Tony Snow, and he said, yeah, I think I've heard about you, but I don't have any time for you right now. Can you come back tomorrow? I said, no, I'm leaving.
Mm-hmm.
So I left, and boy, it wasn't the next day Hannity was calling me to be on Hannity and Combs because they'd had it up there. So I went on Hannity and Combs, and then from then on, I mainly did TV and radio.
Okay.
But it was, the thing about it was, is nobody, and I can't stress this enough, nobody told anybody what to say
mm-hmm.
in the whole campaign.
Right.
Nobody, you know, benefited from it financially. And the hell of it was is that out of all the people that were on there was 270 of us, there was probably 30 of us on the board, so to speak, the main steering committee. There were Democrats, Republicans, and a whole lot of us independents.
Mm-hmm.
And none of us had any connection with the Republican Party in any way whatsoever.
Right.
And every time we get blasted, you know, Karl Rove, God, I never talked to Karl Rove.
Right.
And I was on the one main steering committee. You know, it just didn't happen.
Right.
And so it was a grassroots. Matter of fact, we've gotten a lot of flack. About 6 months ago, they called and asked us, why aren't we getting involved? I said, well, we disbanded 4 years ago. We're no longer an organization. Oh, well, but we thought you were a Republican group that were going to help us. And I said, no, we're not. And I said, you know, I said, well, that's what everybody else has said. I said, yeah. I said, we disbanded 4 years ago. We had a, after the election, and we stayed up because there were several of us that thought we were going to have to go to Costa Rica when it was over.
Right.
We stayed up and watched it. And I finally, about 1 o'clock, I said, I think we're safe. But we had one more meeting. We met in Orlando, Florida, about a month after the election and had a big mission accomplished party.
Okay.
And that was the last time we met together.
All right.
As a group. And we disbanded. We had to keep some money around in case lawyers or any other problems.
Mm-hmm.
But we disbanded. And I kept telling people, I said, we were not a political group. We're a group of people that just want to stop John Kerry.
Right.
And they said, well, why aren't you trying to stop Barack Obama? I said, we didn't serve with him.
Right.
No reason to.
Right. Uh-huh.
So, but that's the thing that always got me is the press never understood that we were a group of people trying to tell our story, and we were just shut out, so we had to become a 527.
Mm-hmm.
And after we became a 527 and started, they thought we were some kind of political organization, and we really weren't. Like I said, there's probably not as many, but there are probably quite a few Democrats in our group, too.
Mm-hmm.
And but just we all had the same horrible distaste for John Kerry. And one of the things that came out was that we wished it had been anybody else running for president that had been a Swift Boat officer, because we would have been happy to support them 100%.
Mm-hmm.
But just not him.
All right. When the night of the election and when the election results came out, you talked a little bit about the party and the celebration. How did you feel? I mean,
oh, relieved, happy,
right,
glad.
Mm-hmm.
And I was not a George Bush supporter at all.
Right.
I wish the hell we'd had two other choices.
Mm-hmm.
But not the lesser, but just what John Kerry did to us when he came back from Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
And the way he, I mean, if you realize it, in 6 short weeks, he got more medals than Audie Murphy.
Right.
Collected. I mean, except for the Medal of Honor. I mean, he just was running through them. And one of his Purple Hearts was self-inflicted, but they were all just barely, they were scratches. Mm-hmm. I mean, scratches. You couldn't even see one of them.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, he pulls that stuff and he wants to be President of the United States. Well, crap, no. It's just not going to happen.
Right.
And we were, I was just relieved and happy. But, yeah, we had our mission accomplished party, banquet, and we invited several of our big contributors to it.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that always amazed me was I was saying, well, you're being given money by Republicans. I said, yeah, the Democrats aren't going to give us any money because we're going against John Kerry, people.
Right.
Why is that surprising?
Mm-hmm.
And but it, we could never, ever, and you see stuff all the time about, you know, the Swift Boat Group and all this stuff, and the press always got it wrong. Always got it wrong. They never knew who we were or what we were doing. They still haven't got it wrong. It'll go down in history wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what upsets me.
Right. All right. Well, before we wrap things up, I have a few broad questions to ask you about about your opinion on the war and your participation, and you can say as much or as little as you want about these.
Okay.
First of all, looking back on your experience in the war, what's your opinion of American foreign policy towards Vietnam and during that time period?
Oh, it's totally screwed up.
Mm-hmm.
We could have had Ho Chi Minh on our side during the Eisenhower administration.
Right.
We stepped in it every way we could. Ho Chi Minh wanted to be allied with us,
mm-hmm.
and we could have done that. And then we put in we deposed a dictator and put another one in that wasn't. We helped depose an elected official and then put a dictator in, basically,
right.
And then supported him. And he was extremely corrupt. No, we stepped in it every which way we could. We lost the war politically. We lost the war at the highest level,
mm-hmm.
through inept activities by the State Department, by the executive branch of the government, both parties.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you think the U.S. should have been involved in Vietnam?
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so.
Okay.
As it turned out, their country is really doing quite well right now.
Mm-hmm.
And we lost the war, so I would have to say no.
Okay. All right. How closely did you follow the war after you left?
Every night.
Mm-hmm.
Walter Cronkite.
Okay. All right.
I'm a news junkie. I always watch the news.
Right. How did you feel when on April 30th Saigon fell?
By that time, I was pretty much out of it. I was in college, and as a matter of fact, we had a pool on which was going to fall first, Phnom Penh or Saigon.
Mm.
I guess I was pretty much disgusted by the loss of what we had incurred of 58,000 men.
Right.
And gone into something and then just tossed it away.
Mm-hmm.
Because you see that. Well, you still see it in government today, but yes, no, I was disgusted by our government.
Mm-hmm.
I really didn't care about the country, but I was disgusted by what our government had done to our people.
Right. Okay. And a last question for you. How did your experiences in Vietnam affect you, or did they at all?
Oh, yeah, greatly.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to say it was one of those experiences, and I've talked about this to my buddies before. We were talking about this this last week.
Mm-hmm.
It's something I'd never want to do.
Right.
But I'm glad I did it.
Mm-hmm.
It affected me in such ways as I don't really sweat the small stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I'm willing to take chances. And I guess it's that old, I don't feel as much as a B-52 pilot that just got back from bombing Germany, but you feel like you're living on borrowed time, so you don't try to hold back on anything.
Mm-hmm.
All in all, it was a great experience for me because I've never been afraid of anybody or anything since then. So it was that, and I see a lot of my friends that I've worked with over the years that did not have that military experience. And they'll make statements like, well, you know, I guess I wish I had done that. And I know they do. And all you can say is that I would never want anyone to go through that, and I would never go through it again myself. But I'm glad I did. I'm glad I've got this experience behind me. Because it has helped me greatly.
Right. Okay. Well, before we wrap things up, is there any last thing you'd like to say about your experiences before we bring the interview to a close?
I don't believe so.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll stop the recording here, and then if you don't mind, I'll talk to you for just a few more minutes.
Okay.
Okay.